Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
We all know some of the key skills you need to succeed in business. Perseverance, empathy, creativity, focus. But how do people build them? Today's guest argues that Black Americans do it from childhood, and that organizations large and small need to start recognizing them for it. Because when you're up against systemic racism and constantly navigating classrooms and workplaces where you're in the minority, you learn grit. You pay more attention to what other people are thinking and feeling. You get resourceful, and you work a hell of a lot harder than everyone else to prove you deserve your spot at the table. Chad Sanders began his career in corporate roles at Google and then helped lead a technology startup before becoming a writer and musician. For his new book, he talked to 15 Black leaders from diverse fields about their experiences at home, school, and work. He wanted to figure out what helped them get to the top and to showcase those skills for everyone else, not just aspiring leaders of color, but also white peers and bosses. His book is called Black Magic, What Black Leaders Learned from Trauma and Triumph. Chad, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
So I'd love to first talk about your personal story. You grew up in Maryland. You went to Morehouse, which is a historically Black college. You started out at Google, which is one of the world's most prestigious companies, in a pretty cool job. But you had trouble at first. Why?
I was unadjusted to whiteness as a cultural setting, to be specific. I went to very mixed schools growing up. My high school was about 50% white, 40% Black, 10% other races. And so I was very much adjusted to sort of white culture and white social cues at that point in my life. But I went down to Atlanta, Georgia to Morehouse College, to an HBCU for college. And Atlanta is a very Black city. My school was 97% Black. And so when I got to Google and I saw that the operating system was entirely, you know, it was so different. It was this sort of preppy, prestigious, but sort of dressed down, casual, bro code type of environment. And I had just forgotten how to acquiesce to that sort of world. And it hit me like a ton of bricks. And I got sad and I got confused. And I decided that to get into the club and to be included and to feel like I had a chance to be promoted and to be a leader at that company, I needed to make myself whiter.
So that's like the ultimate code switch, you know, being one thing to a certain set of people and then becoming another for a different group. Why is that so hard psychologically? And did you find it to be successful?
Well, it's hard because you're trying to make yourself be someone that you're not. And your body and your mind and your spirit can feel the jarring transition between identities every day as you dress yourself up to be someone else, which includes the way that you talk. It includes the way that you dress. But I think with more depth, it includes what you say that you like, what you say that you're familiar with, your music tastes, your food tastes, the way that you talk about friendships and travel. In my case, the way that you make up places that you've been so that you sound like you have had a privileged cultural upbringing that, similar to your, you know, Ivy League colleagues. But if I pull it even further a layer back, it's painful because it feels so necessary. As a 22-year-old in my first job at this huge company that at the time was about 15 years old, Google was my chance to enter industry at the highest level. I mean, I wrapped my entire identity around how can I be googly? How can I be someone that fits in here, someone that they want to keep around? Because it seemed like that was the key to industry. And I tried to emulate as best I could whatever behaviors I saw that would make me appear that way. It was a losing game.
And so it didn't work.
It did not work. What it worked to do was to make me feel inadequate. What it worked to do was to make me feel like I had a job on top of my actual job, which was to present myself as someone who was harmless, safe, reasonable, likable to white people. And it dulled so many of the sort of things that are core and most intrinsic to me in nature. It dulled my blackness, which, you know, I see as something that's been a very positive part of my identity. Now I see it that way. You know, I learned as a 6-year-old, as an 8-year-old, as a middle schooler, how to think quickly on my feet because of the nature, the risky and high stake nature of being a black kid in this country. I learned how to have empathy for different people early on in my life, because as a black person thrown into environments full of white people, Asian people, Latinx people, you know, people that didn't look like me and people that looked like me, I had to be able to pick up on social cues very fast and on what people liked and didn't like and what made them feel safe and what made them feel afraid very quickly. Because again, the stakes for a black kid, if you don't pick up on those things, are that someone could see you as unsafe and someone could cause you harm or call the police to cause harm to you in that way. So those were the things I was giving away. Those were sort of the built and learned abilities that I was giving away by pretending to be somebody else. And eventually when I came to realize the value of those things, they have benefited me very greatly in business and in art.
And I know it's hard to generalize. You've been talking about Google because that's where you worked, but you seem to be suggesting that a lot of institutions and organizations and cultures around the United States feel the same for Black Americans and maybe people of color more broadly. There's this emphasis today on bringing diversity in, but at the same time, the culture tends to overwhelm those diverse viewpoints and stifle them, really.
Yeah, that's right. Google was not unique in that way. Google was, in a lot of ways, aspirational to other companies that wanted to be more inclusive. They saw Google as a shining star of inclusivity. So if we just sort of break it down, Google, Facebook, and JP Morgan, in my research for this book, I saw that they all reported fewer than, let's say to be safe, under 6% Black employees at entry levels and far beneath that at leadership levels. Of the Fortune 500 companies in this country, 5 of them have Black CEOs. So that's 1%. This diversity problem, and frankly, this Blackness problem, exists at the biggest companies, at the shining star companies that other companies want to be like, all the way from the most entry-level jobs, entry-level practitioners, all the way up to the C-suites of these companies and the boards of these companies. In my opinion, it is safe to generalize that we as Black people have a toxic relationship with the corporate workforce in this country. In order to change that, you know, you don't tell someone with a toxic relationship with a partner or with drugs, I'm talking about a really bad relationship, you don't tell them,
keep trying to make it work.
Yeah, you don't tell them to like just change the type of tequila that they drink. You tell them to, you tell them to quit. You tell them to go cold turkey. You know, you tell them to go find something else that makes them happy or brings them joy or sustains them or gives them livelihood. And so in my opinion, because this relationship is toxic, you know, I think we've talked ourselves blue in the face with diversity and inclusion programs and, you know, programs to hire Black folks at the entry levels. I think Black people are going to have to start building our own companies. And I mean, we have done that. We've seen the number of Black owned and Black started companies in the last 30 years double. I think that trend is going to continue if we continue to see corporations, big corporations, as a place that's not healthy for us to work.
I definitely want to delve into entrepreneurship, but I first want to ask, you know, as you recount in your book, when you embraced your own black magic and started being more authentic, you actually became more successful in this large organization. So why not take that approach? And you interviewed lots of people who were successful at big companies too.
I would recommend that approach if your reality is that you need the safety and the salary of a big corporation. I would recommend that you try the boldness of being yourself at work. I found when I made that sort of switch to my own persona as a very entry-level person working at a big company that it changed the way people responded to me. You know, when I started to speak of my own voice and throat, when I started to really call out colleagues when I found their behavior or the way that they treated me to be objectionable, when I stopped feeding into company consensus and just echoing the loudest or most powerful voice in the room and started to speak with my own keen eye of opinion, things were different for me. You know, I became a little bit more polarizing as a colleague, but the people who liked me and who vouched for me and who wanted to put their energies behind me really felt strongly that way. And they helped me get new opportunities. I think, you know, what I learned was you don't get brownie points for being a sheep, even at a corporation. You might get to stick around a little bit longer, but you know, the people who have made it to the top layers of some of these businesses, a lot of them have done it by taking big risk, even within the corporation. They've done it by building their leverage, by doing something bold, by doing something a little scary. That change for me was important.
So I want to dig into your research, your interviews with all of these Black leaders. These are people who've been successful at corporate jobs and as entrepreneurs. If there's one skill that you would point to that all of them had, you know, they developed it because of their experience growing up Black in America and then were able to flip it and use it to their advantage at work, what would it be?
Oh, that's easy. The answer is faith.
Hmm.
I don't mean that in the religious sense necessarily, although many of my subjects in the book did learn their faith in church. But these people, to a person, every single interview subject, at some point in their careers, for many of whom this point came in their mid-20s, they stopped making decisions based on what they thought, and they started making decisions based on what they believed. And those two schools or worlds of decision-making live in different places, even in your body. You know, people talk about, they used words like, when I went to Howard University, I felt like I could breathe. When I went and started working at Goldman Sachs and realized I was the only Black person there, I felt suffocated. They talk a lot about what they felt in their bodies as they were making decisions along the way. And then they start talking about listening to their guts and their hearts. And that to me is about belief. I think that to be a powerful or successful entrepreneur, to be a powerful or successful or effective leader in an organization, at a company, at a corporation, whatever the case may be, you have to sort of form yourself around a belief in a product, a service, a way of thinking, and ultimately yourself in order to get from A to B. And each one of these leaders pointed to that sort of ability to believe and make decisions boldly without being lost in thought or lost in regret or lost in fear about what could happen if they made these decisions, as sort of the intrinsic learning from Blackness that allowed them to propel. And I think that that faith and that belief comes from realizing at some point that you've already beaten the odds just by being alive, well, having a little bit of money in your bank account, being free as a Black person of a certain age, because the statistics will make it seem daunting for you. In a lot of ways, the media and the way that Black people are portrayed, and even the sort of tales of fear and tragedy and domestic terrorism and horrible atrocities against Black people, can make you think that you don't really have a shot here.
Hmm.
But to just get through all of that and end up on a trading floor or at an insurance company or selling automobiles or working at Cisco or Netflix or Google, like, you have done something incredible. And I think that ultimately gives people this foundation of belief in themselves and their work product that's outstanding.
One of the other aspects of Black Magic that you point to is perseverance. And it seems like the perseverance is creating the faith, and then the faith is giving people the ability to persevere further, you know, to achieve more, to keep working even when they're still being discounted.
Yeah, that's right. My friend Garth, he's Black man CFO of a company called Latch, which is they make smart locks. It's a sort of a growing and hot tech startup. And he said something to me the other day, I guess something he'd read, which was success is stamina. And I think that's absolutely right. I think to make anything important happen in this world, it's going to be a slog. It's going to be a long, painful journey in some regards. And that is the experience of Blackness for so many people.
So let's talk a little bit more about being the only, you know, whether it's in a middle school gifted and talented program or a college fraternity or research lab or a boardroom, it can feel awful. You know, some of the stories that you recount in your book are painful, but can it also be an asset? Are there other ways that you stand out because you're the only one there, or have more of a voice because you're the only one there?
Well, two things. So first, it can be both physically and figuratively painful. The stories in the book portray moments where people were treated terribly by quote unquote friends and colleagues, where people were forced to live under and differently than the people around them. That's figurative. And quite frankly, it can be physically painful as well. There are moments of violence portrayed in the book. To answer your question, it's dangerous, and I have to be very specific about how I represent quote unquote advantages. The net summation of all of this is that you are still not at any advantage by accessing these gifts of Black magic. The net summation is you have a chance to navigate a maze that is built to work against you. That's not the same as an advantage. So yes, if you take advantage of the fact that you are noteworthy at your company, because people are going to remember your name, they're going to be watching you, there's going to be pressure on you. If you take advantage of that sort of notoriety, if you use it to build influence, if you use it to act boldly, if you use it to speak up at a company all hands and know that everybody's going to remember who said that thing because they look different than everyone else, that is empowering. That is taking initiative on what you have to work with. But to call it an advantage when what you are up against is the sea of comforting, cultural comforting that is whiteness that underpins most company cultures, no, it's not fair to call it an advantage, but it's a tool and you have it. So you might as well use it. And that's really what I'm trying to say in this book.
One of the phrases in the book that I highlighted was from Shelley Stewart, who's a partner at McKinsey, the soft bigotry of low expectations, which is really hurtful, but something that he was able to seize upon. So talk a little bit about how he did that and how you see other people doing it.
Yeah, well, what Shelley's saying there is that as a Black person at a company, it is likely that people are going to expect you to be able to do less. It is likely that people will see you as a diversity hire, as some form of corporate affirmative action, as someone who probably had lower test scores or came from a worse school or came from a lower positioning in their class at a quote unquote good school, but got this job because companies have quotas to fill. And when you enter a company on those terms, the messed up part, the part that it works to your disadvantage, is it dulls your voice. People don't hear you as loudly when they think that you didn't come in with the same sort of accolades or skill set or abilities as them. When you are presented tasks or objectives to fill that are of lower priority because people have less of a faith in your abilities, it's likely that you're going to be able to knock those things out of the park really quickly early on, because you do have an equal to or favorable skill set to everyone that you work with, not necessarily the same skill set. And if you do knock those things out of the park, you are going to start building momentum as someone who is seen as a doer. And if you make yourself and your boss and their boss look good by getting those things done, it's possible, if you are ravenous and if you are vigilant about seeking out greater opportunities, that you'll get those. And if you execute those too, now you start having a track record, and that's something that you can leverage at a company. And I always want to be clear to use the word leverage, because I don't believe that at some point in all of this, goodwill is going to get you passed on to the next level, to the next promotion, to the next bonus. I think for us, we always have to seize it with leverage, with track record, with dollars earned for the company. You know, nepotism is not going to work in our favor. And that is clear by the fact that so many companies are in a crisis where they say, man, we hire 5% Black people into the entry-level jobs here, but we just can't get them up to the director level. People get their friends up to the director level. They get people that remind them of themselves up to the director level. If you don't have leverage, that's not going to happen for you.
Right. Do you feel that we're making any progress in the United States, particularly after the corporate response to the killing of George Floyd, many other deaths at the hands of police, all the Black Lives Matter protests? You know, are people getting hiring better? Are they getting promoting better? And are we getting to a point where Black people, other marginalized groups, can really be themselves in predominantly white organizations?
Progress is tricky. If I zoom far in and I were to work with a statistician or an economist to figure out, did we go from 5% hiring to 6% hiring at entry-level jobs at Fortune 500 companies, I am sure that in some way we could claim a victory in the last 9 months. That feels like incrementalism, and I am a millennial, and we are entitled about the things that we want, wanting them now. And we don't believe, I'm talking about all of us, white, Black, whatever, like, we don't believe in incrementalism. We believe in restructuring. We believe in fast change. We believe in disruption. And my point of view is that I don't want to measure entry-level jobs for diversity and inclusion anymore. What I think is important is, if we look at the tops of these companies, if we look at the boards, the C-suites, and the majority shareholders of these companies, have the faces up there changed? Because if they haven't, these are just members clubs. Like, if those faces haven't changed, the culture is not going to change. And therefore, I don't think we should try to claim progress if we're just sort of doing a rinse repeat on hiring and firing people of color, Black people, at the bottoms of these companies. I think in short, the answer is no, but I do think that we have the information and a little bit of the attention of the national agenda right now to make progress. So this is an important moment for all of us. And I think it behooves us to educate ourselves on what's happening right now and make some moves.
And so what exactly should organizations be doing?
Well, they should have, in the same way that they will set hiring quotas at the low levels of companies, they should have representational quotas for C-suites, boards, and majority shareholders. That is a point of view that people will shout me down on from the rooftops, because it doesn't sound like a capitalist point of view, but I think it is. I think that the net benefit to the points of view of these companies, to their vision, to their understanding of their audiences and their consumer bases and the cultures at those companies and the ways that they're able to foster talent. You know, it's my opinion that when you hire someone who is just different from the other people that they work with. That doesn't mean that they're black. That could mean they're a woman. That could mean that they're gay. That could mean that they're trans, whatever it is. I think it ultimately does lend to a more inclusive workspace for other people that don't share identities with those people either. And so I say all that to say, I do think that that's a capitalist vision. I do think that's going to improve the companies that we're talking about. I do think that's going to be good for our economy.
Particularly if those people are also able to be their authentic selves at work.
That's right. But yeah. Nobody gets to be their authentic selves at work except for the people at the very tippy top of these places. And so if we change what those people look like, I do believe that it opens the doors for more types of people all over those businesses. That's what the organization should do. Mm-hmm. Now, am I counting on it? Of course not. So what I think the people who work at those organizations should do, and not just the black people, but again, anybody who doesn't feel like they have a healthy relationship with their workplace, is they should pay attention to the entrepreneurial movement that is happening in this country right now, where people are taking back the value of their own time, of their own goods and services that they can produce, and finding ways to start their own businesses where they get to decide what the culture is. That's, to me, a more practical solution or outcome to what's happening here. And I think the companies will then adjust, because that's about leverage.
Chad, thanks so much for talking with me today.
Thank you.
Context of white supremacy. You have to bear with me for a few seconds. I am in thought about the very last portion of what we heard in the audio segment, Victim of White Supremacy, Chad Sanders, black male, where he was talking about, he said that no one gets to be their authentic self at work. I had many thoughts around that. I thought our caller in Florida, where he said some of the CLIC members at the courthouse, he said that one of the white women, she had a social media post where she said her true self, and it was some sort of demon, a devil, with me propped up. Now, apparently she was saying, hey, I don't get to be my authentic self in the workplace. See, gotta smile and be nice when I'm a demon authentically. So I did think of that. I also thought of the segment on This American Life where they said that at fire departments plural, they had such a widespread problem with white firefighters urinating on the property and beverages of other firefighters that they had to make promotional videos to discourage this misconduct. If you feel comfortable enough to whip out your penis, I'm assuming these were males, may not have been, white women, dangerous too. You feel comfortable enough to urinate in a colleague's beverage on the job, I'd say you are pretty comfortable. I think if that is not your authentic self, that has got to be in the ballpark. All that to say, I don't know. I have seen many, many white people in the workplace. I am sure that some of them, you know, they lie and are just, I guess, giving us a professional presentation, right? I'm sure a lot of that goes on. I have also seen a lot of uncouth white people, like, drinking in the workplace, swearing in the workplace, wear whatever they want, conducting experiments. Like, I have seen a lot of lawless behavior where it looks like, hey, I'm doing me all day long, whether I'm doing me on the couch at home, doing me in the workplace. Like, I have seen a lot of that with white people too. So yeah, I have to think about that. Chad Sanders, VGQ, but I have to think about that. I guess you all can share on that too. Do you think white people are behaving as their quote unquote authentic self? We can ponder what that means too, but is that what's happening in the workplace? We'll think. Anywho, Gusty Renegade, context of white supremacy. This is Friday, March 5, 2021, so I have been told. Neutralizing Workplace Racism, our weekly segment exclusively focused on attempting to solve problems without creating new problems in the workplace. This is not a program for spectators. This is not the let me tune in and hear the troubles of some of the niggers or other victims of racism. Their travails on the workplace, how white women and white men are beating them down. That is not what this is for. If certainly you should be on speed dial, if you have figured out any strategies that are worthwhile, help us solve some of the problems in dealing with white people or non-white people in the workplace. If you figured out any helpful information with regards to if you want to get the vaccine, fine, doing that and how that plays out in the workplace. If you don't want to do it, this is what can help out in the workplace. Staying safe either way, staying safe in the workplace. I know this week there were several states which drastically reduced restrictions and safety protocols. Texas, I think, is one. Some of the others in the so-called South, where I'm pretty sure that probably impacted some workplaces. I think they went back to saying you could have 100% capacity in your business. So that might have drastically changed things in the workplace this week. If you have any thoughts to share, tips, strategies to share, be on speed dial. If you're having problems, difficulties of some nature and would like suggestions, logical counter-racist suggestions to help solve a problem without creating new problems, the number 720-716-7300. The code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Number again, 720-716-7300. The code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. If you can recall, folks who were with us at the very beginning, the audio segment with Mr. Chad Sanders, author of Black Magic, What Black Leaders Learned from Trauma and Triumph. He was a guest on the Harvard Business Review HBR cast. I think I said for a year or some years at this point that every time I hear a segment from their podcast where they talk about workplace issues, I feel astronomically better about neutralizing workplace racism. Like, if that's what gets to pass off as constructive information from an Ivy League institution, we are like next level. Like, if that's the best Harvard can do, like, gee whiz, they should retire right now. But that was Chad Sanders, victim of white supremacy, VGQ. As I was hearing that, so like I said, if you can kind of keep that in mind, I'll have a few thoughts to share about that. But I was going to read this report anyway. It just became even more glaring as I heard Mr. Sanders. This is from the BBC just a couple days ago. The report is titled "Failing Up: Why Some Climb the Ladder Despite Mediocrity," and it's got a picture of white people at the top, white men and a white woman. And it's the lackluster associate, probably white, who makes partner despite a poor record, even though you've been working around the clock at the same firm without even a glance from the bosses. It's getting passed up for that big account after being at an agency for 5 years, only to see your unremarkable but charismatic colleague score the project after two. Or maybe it's that ineffective manager who, despite poor people skills, continues to get more staff and responsibility. Most of us know the frustrating feeling of watching someone fail upward, someone white likely, landing successfully successively sweeter gigs even after professional mediocrity or missteps. It turns out allowing employees to fail up isn't necessarily bad and can sometimes yield talented, resilient leaders. What is troubling, experts say, is the significant gap between who's allowed to fail without penalty on the way up and who never gets a chance. Now, as we get to this portion, they have photos of black people. They have a white man who is doing the talking, and they have a black female and a black male who are both listening to this white man who is in the center, or at least to me it looks like someone who would be classified as white. So I'm skipping down a little bit. The privilege of failing up. There's that P word again. When we do ask those questions, however, the role of privilege, power, becomes more evident. At a panel held during the 2019 Austin Film Festival, the co-creators and co-writers behind the Emmy Award-winning drama series Game of Thrones explained that while they were both writers, neither had any television experience when the show began. David Benioff and D.B. Weiss said they were allowed to take several risks, even though it was their first time running a production, and their unaired original pilot required recasting, rewrites, and reshoots before it was finally accepted. It took more than one try, which we were fortunate to get a second chance, said Weiss. Benioff added, a lot of the mistakes were basic, elemental writing mistakes. Illiterate, that's what it'd be if you're a black person. The comments at the festival sparked a larger conversation on social media about who exactly is allowed to fail in workplaces and still get support, another chance, and, as in this case, find their way to success. In a lot of organizations, the people who are allowed to fail and fail up, the people who are allowed to learn from those mistakes and still be given an opportunity to get back up again, are overwhelmingly white. Says are overwhelmingly male and overwhelmingly white. Should have been the focus on white. Reverse that. Overwhelmingly white and then overwhelmingly male. Says Ruchika Tulshyan, founder of the Seattle-based inclusion strategy firm Candor. You got to be joking. This is from the BBC, no less. A 2020 research paper from the Utah State University reveals women, and get this, B-I-P-O. C. I think the B is black. POC, I think, is people of color. I don't know what the I is. Could be in a race. BIPOC. My goodness, the word salad continues. So Utah State University reveals women and BIPOC employees in elite leadership roles who make even minor missteps at work, from dress code to displays of emotion, can be judged much more harshly than white men. Not white women, get out of here. For many of us, we only have one shot to try, says Tulshyan. Therefore, we will instinctively try and safeguard ourselves. If you don't feel like you can take risks in your career, it is that much harder to grow. I will stop there. They do go on to explicitly mention racism right in the next paragraph, but you can check it out on your own. They talk about, you know, promotions, hiring, all the rest of it. Nothing earth-shattering. But that's I saw that report earlier this week, and I was going to just share a little bit of it anyway. But then as Mr. Sanders was talking in his report, like, I thought of it repeatedly. Again, you know, VGQ. There were so many metaphors within his commentary. I encourage people to pay attention to metaphors. He described the relationship that black workers have in racist workplaces as toxic, totally accurate. And he said, it's like someone being in a toxic relationship. You don't tell them to change the tequila. You tell them to quit cold turkey. I thought, wow, I guess I would recommend not using alcoholic metaphors, especially since I think we do hear from time to time sobriety would be best. But in a workplace setting, number one, I recommend that you be the person who is always trying to weasel out of getting to the bar and having happy hour and doing some aspect of our workplace meeting at an environment where we can drink. You're always the person that's weaseling out of that, and sobriety would be best, and oh no, I don't want to meet at the bar and that type of thing. So you want to have your behavior match the metaphors that you choose. Also, I think for maybe all Black people, we are not regarded as professional. I think Mr. Sanders was talking about that, where so many Black people we're thought of as angry, and emotional, and unprofessional, and all the rest of it. I would not use metaphors that suggest partying, or that people might attach you with alcohol and party time, entertainment, something other than business, being professional. So that's just one. I would not pick alcohol-related metaphors. And all of that, he was giving all of that in the context of encouraging Black people to be entrepreneurs, start their own companies. I'm not opposed to that at all. We've talked to a number of so-called Black entrepreneurs over the years. Spectacular. I think we've even had some folks of late who've talked about, hey, I'm, you know, looking to get out so I can be self-employed and mitigate some of this racism that I'm experiencing. Spectacular. Don't be confused. Don't think just because you become an entrepreneur that now there is no more racism. False. It just, and I think even some of the folks that we've heard from have said, as a matter of fact, I think all of the Black entrepreneurs that we've talked to have said, oh yeah, there's been some racism. Sometimes there's been lots of racism because you still have to deal with white people. Still might have to get a certificate, a license, sometimes several of them that might have to be an annual renewal type thing. And then you might have white clients and lots of different ways that you will still have to deal with racist man, racist woman, racist child. In fact, we play reports where sometimes it's none of the above. Sometimes it's just you have your business in a physical location and racists find out that your business is there. They know how to commit vandalism. Lots of different ways that you have to deal with white supremacy racism as an entrepreneur. So don't think that that will solve the problem at all. He was asked, I feel like white people, sometimes it's a really tacky display when they do interviews with a Black person talking about racism. Now I realize, hey, you want to promote your book or whatever it is, but it's just extremely tacky. They will ask questions. She asked him. Now, they will call us disadvantaged when they're not calling us nigger and coon and spear chucker and all the rest of it. They will call us disadvantaged, right? Then she will come around after they spent, you know, 15, 20 minutes and, oh, you don't fit in and all the rest of it. And you fail at being a white guy and, oh, my goodness. And they've only got 5 niggers at the Fortune 500 companies. And, oh, my word. And da, 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 da. And then come back and say, well, what do you think is the advantage to being a nigger? What do you think is the advantage to all this? And then he has to sit there in buckets of words. And I'm not saying that as an indictment. It's the indictment is of this white woman at the Harvard Business Review podcast. Why would you even ask a question like that? Would you bring somebody on who had been on? That's why I said, if we think about this as a crime, if we brought on one of Jeffrey Epstein's victims, bring on one of these white women, would you ask, hey, what do you think was the advantage? Do you think it made you stronger to be raped as a teen? I don't think they do that. I don't think they do that. It's only racism. They say, oh, yes, the nigger has been made stronger. All those lashes from slavery. Yes. All those firings and being turned down and rejected for a job. Didn't that make you tough? Didn't that make you an advantage, nigger, Mr. Sanders? It's disgusting. And it promotes confusion. If you hear that and you don't understand racism, white supremacy, you might be trying to twist it. Well, yeah, you know, I'm a strong black man. I'm a strong black. Well, we are strong black people. And yes, because we just get right back. Get out of here. That is total nonsense. And the white people, when they ask these questions, they know it. In fact, even before I get into some of the other portions, he started the conversation and he said he came into this work environment after being graduating from Morehouse, historically black university. Bravo. He comes into the work environment, and he said, I think he said even before that, his school environment had like 40% black students and then other, and then I think like 50% white students or what have you. So he said he'd had kind of a more diverse school setting. And so then he goes into this predominantly white environment in Silicon Valley tech industry. And he said he's not prepared. He said it was frustrating. He was confused and sad. I would have appreciated much more detail because he said he was not adjusted to whiteness, as opposed to spending all that time and aren't you an advantaged Negro? Whoa, 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 whoa. What does that mean? You are not adjusted to whiteness. Like, explain that. Like, in my view, my suspicion would be that that is racism, white supremacy. Like, unless you could tell me some specific details, like, were they not speaking English? They were speaking English? Okay. American English? Like, it wasn't some Australian mate and all the... Okay, American English. Okay, okay. They were using paper? Standard paper? Okay, they were using paper. They had computers? Okay, telephones? Standard things that you've seen. But you've seen a white person before, right? He didn't say he went to a school that was like... or before Morehouse, right? He said he didn't go to a school that was like exclusively black. There were white people there. So, I mean, I am not understanding. And even I was thinking like, really? Like Morehouse has its graduates that unprepared to go into a corporate environment with like all white people? Like, I don't know. If I was a faculty member at Morehouse, like I would feel some type of way like, man, like that should not be happening. But again, I would need more details. I would need him to unpack it because it could just be that when he says he was not adjusted to whiteness, that could mean that it was just white people were practicing racism, white supremacy against him. Like, because he said it was this bro culture. He didn't even say it was like a, or I don't know, maybe it was, but he said it was a bro culture, kind of a casual dress type of a thing. I don't know if he was, I don't know. He didn't give me enough detail in terms of what was the exact problem in terms of his maladjustment to whiteness. Also, the language, he used so much whiteness that is so common. That's why my definition is a global system of people who classify themselves as white. I don't know what we're to, Dr. Welsing used to say that all the time. I don't know what you're talking about when we start talking about whiteness. Are you talking about cotton candy? Are you talking about clouds? What are you talking about? You're talking about people classified as white. In fact, that I think, again, just even getting back to that, what does that mean? Not well adjusted to whiteness, white people. What does that mean? Continuing. And he said he was sad, right, because of not being adjusted. He said he was sad and confused. And he said that he had to work to present himself as reasonable, smart. Say he had a long list. And I just thought, oh, my God, like I would have serious mental problems if I felt like the people that I work with, they do not think of me like everything that he said. So they don't think of me as reasonable, smart, logical, intelligent, qualified for this job, basically Negro. Okay, so I have to try to convince them and prove them. You, what he said, sad and confused, absolutely, and depressed probably. Not understanding racism, white supremacy. And again, they have it that affirmative action, these unqualified niggers. I was going to say that. I said that when we had Elizabeth Gillespie McCray, white woman on the program, you people should think of you when they think of somebody who is unqualified and got this spot and is not deserving. It's Mark Furman. When he complained about affirmative action, he was complaining about white women because they didn't even have Rodney King on the police force. It was Peggy York. And white women, they should be the ones that are like, oh, man, I feel some type of way. I don't know. Am I an imposter? I don't deserve to be here. I faked my SAT scores and all the rest. Not black people. Like generally black people are over qualified. Like, you have PhD janitors and what have you cleaning the toilet to have this position. I'm underpaid and extra work. John Henryism. Lies all the way. Anyway, but I heard all of this. I'm not sure that VGQ, I guess that's all I can say. I guess you can check out Mr. Sanders' book to see. Maybe he gives more detail in the book about what he meant when he said he was not well adjusted to whiteness, and some of the details about what he tried to do to prove his reasonableness and intelligence and worthiness and all the rest of it. If he has more detail on the book, you can check it out and let us know. It's Black Magic: What Black Leaders Learned from Trauma and Triumph. And then he talks to other black people too, so you can see what, you know, maybe they have something constructive to share as well. Incidentally, I will say I see white people promote black people using the term black magic. I generally see it around more frequently around, it'll be black girl magic and all of that. I'm not a proponent of the using of that phrase, pairing black people with magic. I don't know anything about magic that may exist. I'm ignorant about many things. Magic would be another. But the main thing is that I think if it was black logic, white people would not be promoting that. It's real easy and kind of a racist history to connect black people to nigger cats. You got Negro Cat Day coming up soon, to connect black people to some sort of witchcraft. And Jeffrey Toobin kept saying that the Simpson team was conjuring some sort of to see. It's that, just that whole language fits a long racist trope about the way that we think about black people. Magic is not going to solve our problems, I don't think. Logic. That is black logic. That is getting closer to solving the problem. And again, I don't think white people would be promoting black girl logic. I don't think they would be doing a whole lot of promoting of that. I could be wrong. Anywho, let's see. Chad Sanders, if folks want to check out his work, Chad Sanders, fascinating. I could say a lot more about that. Folks can share a thought or two as we proceed. The email is untiljustice@gmail.com. untiljustice@gmail.com. I got a little bit behind on email, so I'll try to catch up on those today as we roll. Email number one. So we had an investor who got the COVID-19 vaccine some weeks back. You have to get the follow-up shot, you know, within a certain time frame. And they shared before that they were not exactly thrilled about getting the vaccine. They had hesitancy, logical. But they also had reckless coworkers. And this person had disclosed that, hey, it seemed like a lot of these folks are not taking it serious. They're not wearing a mask. They're running around high-fiving and all the rest of it. So, I'm gonna go ahead and get this vaccine and try to balance out my risk. I'd rather get the vaccine, take the risk with that, as opposed to taking my risk with these. I believe it was white people. Put that, it was white people not taking it seriously, because that has been a pattern that people have written in and said that they work with white people who are not taking this seriously and following the protocols. All right, so he writes in, getting the second dose of the Pfizer vaccine specifically. Got the second dose of the Pfizer vaccine today. I have experienced a little soreness at the injection site on both doses, but otherwise no perceived side effect thus far. Since the second dose is reportedly associated with more side effects, I took some Advil anti-inflammatory 1 hour prior to getting it. I'll report back in a few weeks regarding my progress, especially if I start to experience any symptoms. This person is still alive and it's been a couple of weeks, so far so good. I have been taking the supplements that Dr. Lathan, who practiced yoga with her this morning, recommended since her broadcast last spring at the beginning of the COVID-19 pandemic to boost the immune system. I also wrote down her supplement protocol if I should get sick from COVID-19. Lastly, I had a racist suspect coworker test positive for COVID-19. Imagine that. I think the symptoms were relatively mild since they were not hospitalized. They were allowed to come back to work 7 days after diagnosis since they were asymptomatic, end quotes. I and other coworkers questioned being allowed to come back so soon since CDC guidelines, I think, suggest longer periods. I believe that's correct, 10 to 14 days. Moreover, the person could easily work from home. The coworker insisted on coming back to work. I have been told they are part of the hoax anti-mask crowd. Are you serious? What in the world? What in the world? And again, they've spent all this time, you know, talking about old Nurse Rivers and black people and their old Tuskegee and remember. Every other day, right? They got reports about that all over the world. Where are the reports on racializing? Why are all of these white people making up all these goofy excuses and hoax this? And I'm not going to. Why are white people behaving like this? Continuing. When we questioned this, we were told that the organization's policy was 7 days if the coworker is asymptomatic. We were told by a supervisor that the company policy is shorter than CDC guidelines because so many people are out with COVID and that the organization could not function if they followed strict CDC guidelines. Jesus. Well, again, why would I be surprised about that if he just said we got all these COVID hoax and anti-mask crowd people? He said this previously. I could go back and get the email, but he said that they were not taking it. That was the whole reason he got the vaccine, because he said, man, these folks are not taking this serious at all. And then we find out, wow, is so many people contaminated, we couldn't even function if we had a strict. Woo! That's what it's been, man. A whole year of this type of foolishness. It's been a whole year of this, even more now. Continuing, moreover, we were told since the coworker has requested to come back to work as an organization. Wait for this one. Wait for this one. Might not make it through 2021. It's been long. All right, there we go. This is worth the wait. I'll give you the full sentence again. Moreover, we were told since the coworker has requested to come back to work as an organization, we cannot discriminate. It does not get any better than Triple T Tacky. Much obliged, sir. Now, see, that's what I mean. He told us that before. I'm going to go ahead and get this vaccine because I would rather take a risk with this than you jokers around here high-fiving every day and chest pumping and, oh, there's no vaccine, making up this COVID schmovid, get out of here. And then, man, I guess we got to have a lax COVID policy because we would have to send everybody home. System of racism, white supremacy in the year of the Rona. I'll read one more email. Let's see. Okay, so we were talking about the school situation. Getting rid of COVID for a second. We were talking about the school situation last week. We had a black mother write in. We were talking about Black History Month is over. Praise. Thank you. So we don't have to talk about that nonsense anymore for school or for work for a good year and Fried Chicken Day and all the rest of it. But we had a black parent, and even Mr. Reed commented about this. We had a black parent, and she was talking about, what should we do in terms of Black History Month? The school is either not acknowledging it at all, or they're doing tacky things, like I just said, Fried Chicken Day, Slavery Day, that type of thing. What should we do about this? We've been talking about this we talked about this all month, basically. Person wrote in, she's a parent too. VGQ, but I do not understand why the callers are expecting the racist suspect teachers at school to teach non-white children meaningful black history. No criticism intended, VGQ, but it should be understood that they do not like us. She has that in all capital letters. I'd actually be grateful if it was left out of the curriculum. That way they can do less harm. Miss, you took the words out of my mouth. Miss me with the fried chicken and watermelon, the baby's parenting skills, etc. They do that sort of thing common. I think it would be better to focus on what you can do at home, providing the children with access to books and other materials that reflect black people at our best. In terms of the school curriculum and environment, I'd focus on ensuring that other subjects are being taught well, that your child is not being mistreated, and importantly, not being exposed to gender confusion studies. Hope you, me, and the callers and listeners have a racism-free week. We will try, not looking good. Excellent suggestions. I think Mr. Reed was talking about that, having his own plan, because he was talking about his grandchild. So, you know, you got to get approval from the parent, he was saying. But he was talking about coming up with his own plan to share information and not just have them sit around and talk about wonderful slave owners like Thomas Jefferson and all the rest of it. I completely agree. Just the schools aren't going to do it correctly. In fact, if you want to juxtapose, you could do this with your child. If they did anything for Black History Month, or if they didn't, no problem. Just have them make note. What did they do? Remember, you can have them write down some notes, right, so they don't forget. What did they do for Black History Month, if anything, right? Now it's March. Women's History Month. Make note if they do anything, and what do they do? And then you'll have a nice comparison. Great little experiment. Maybe they don't do anything for Women's History Month either, because some people, that's not, you know, a big to-do, so... no problem. See, if they ignore all that stuff, fine and dandy. No problem there either. But I suspect for some environments, they will have projects. Excellent opportunity to teach at home. I'll get the rest of the emails as we proceed. UntilJustice@gmail.com. The number again is 720-716-7300. The code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. First, few folks dialed in. If you have commentary to share, if we have folks, if you have thoughts, like I said, I know we have callers in some of the areas where they like totally relaxed COVID restrictions. If that changed your work environment for the better, for the worse, or didn't make any changes at all, please share. If we have folks, I guess if you have thoughts on what we heard from Mr. Chad Sanders, Black Magic, and his workplace experience not being well adjusted to whiteness, and or if we have any other thoughts on the parenting issue that was raised last week. We had other folk, other parents who had a thought on that. Folks who dialed in with a hand up, line should be open. Proceed.
Hello.
Yes, ma'am.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. It's been a long time. I usually work, well, I'm at work now, but I'm on break. I work on Fridays now with the tax season. I thought the conversation with Mr. Sanders was very interesting. Some of the things, I think he talked about the entry level, and I think that's true because where I basically work in customer service, it's tax, like customer service. There are plenty of Black people here. I work at home, but like we can see a lot of people put up their pictures and stuff like that. There are plenty of Black people, white people, Asian people. They're all here. So, yeah, the entry level, especially if it's something like customer service, it's not hard. I don't want to say it's not hard to get in. There's more open. But, I know I'm kind of, I don't want to say I'm quote-unquote valued, but I was hired because I do have my license, and it, the designation, when my name comes up, you can tell that this person has a license because of the little title that they give you. It doesn't have my license there, but you can tell. And so it's important to do those things. I can vouch for, I went to a historically Black college. I don't think they train you to work for white people. I love my school. I had a good time. Yay, Clark Manor, Google. But especially in my major, I think, because my major is accounting, I have one Black teacher. So, and he would tell us things kind of on the side. I don't know, I guess sometimes, he would say some stuff in class and kind of say some stuff on the side about, you know, being the only Black person, because he went to a Black college. And you know how he worked up and, you know, things like that. But if most of the teachers aren't Black, just because you go to a Black school, that doesn't mean you have a Black teacher. You know, A Different World was a TV show. But if you don't have those teachers, then no, you're not going to get those lessons. Now, we were encouraged to get internships and things like that. And definitely if you're going to be an accountant, get your license, you know, things like that. So we encouraged professionally, but the interactions... they had them, but you kind of had to learn as you went. Now I was in high school with white people. Then when I graduated, I worked with white people. And I didn't have those many growing pains because I had interned there before I worked there. So I knew some of the people when I went back and things like that. So yeah, it all depends, but I can say from my experience, I don't think I was necessarily taught this is how you deal with white people in a professional environment. You were taught to be professional and things like that, but those nuanced things, you kind of weren't taught. I don't know if you are taught. I haven't been back to HBCU in a long time. With the parenting, I would say what I said before about osmosis, whatever you want your child to know, just make sure they know it. I think we talked about the black magic and how, you know, whatever, BGQ with that. And be your authentic self at work. I don't know if white people being their authentic self at work because they're not, you know, not all of them are constantly talking down to you and stuff like that. So it depends on the type of job. Like the type of job I've had, I have. Everyone's very polite and very professional. And they've been very, you know, very said very nice things about me. So I personally haven't had any problems, you know, about my work and the things that I do. So, you know, it all depends on the environment. Like this particular job I have, we don't have time. Nobody has the time to cut down, you know, say snide remarks and things like that. We're pretty busy, too much to do. So I think that helps if you're in a job that is really busy and the people are serious about doing what they need to do. You can kind of deter some of that. I'm not going to say it goes away. But I haven't had any of those experiences at this particular place. Not just for everybody, but where I work now. And I work for a big company, the same company I worked for last year that had the fireside chat. So, thank you.
Much obliged, ma'am. That's certainly you have, you know, in a work environment, you have a lot of folks who they know how to be professional, you know, from 9 to 5 and not insult you. And particularly, like you were saying, if you're in a work environment where it's busy and, you know, it's go, 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 you don't have a lot of downtime to go sit around the water cooler and gossip and all the rest of it, that's definitely going to minimize, probably not totally eliminate, but that will definitely reduce the amount of, you know, time that you have for shenanigans and everything. And then absolutely, you probably have people being a little bit more professional, at least professional courtesies type of a thing. The HBCUs now, I would be surprised if Spelman, Grambling, if they were offering a, you know, graduate level class on, you know, corporate white racism 101. Like, I would be stunned if they had such a course, and maybe they'll let me audit it or something like that. But at least like functional, I would think, because like, as you said, like, I don't think, you know, all of the HBCUs, I don't think that necessarily means that they all have black instructors. Like, you know, you can have other people teaching the class and what have you. That just kind of, I'd be curious to hear what some folks at Morehouse, particularly, you know, faculty members, what their thoughts would be like, like maybe that should be addressed, or maybe you didn't take the right classes. Maybe you didn't take advantage of the resources, so you would have been better adjusted to whiteness upon successfully leaving Morehouse.
Well, we had, I'm sorry to cut you off, but we did have one teacher, I never forget, he kept calling us you people. I don't think he stayed that long. I don't know if that's just the way he talks. Like I said, I have positive relationships, even with the white teachers. He liked me, I don't know if that's just the way he was, but I'm like, no, you don't call us, you don't sit in a room, because everybody was black. You know, now it may be more multicultural, but no, everybody was black, and you don't call a room of black people, you people. That was a bad move on his part, but... Yeah.
I'm not surprised. I feel like indirectly that might be preparing you for corporate right there. what you can expect to be talked to. Obviously I didn't go to an HBCU, so, you know, I don't know what that experience would be like in terms of what type of preparation resources that you have. That's fascinating. I have to ponder some more. Maybe we'll get some insight from some of the other folks who dialed in to share. Let's see. And the entry level positions, I for sure, white people, they easily hire lots of folks. We talked about that with either entry level, low paying positions and or temp positions, anything where it's going to be low paying, first hired, no benefits, probably no chance of advancement and promotion, that sort of thing. And then, oh, yes, we have all of the inclusion and diversity. They'll go get the janitor when they go to do the inclusion and diversity, the company's mission statement and how we value everyone. They'll have the CEO and he'll make like, you know, $1.5 million, and they'll have all the other executives. And then it'll be like 10 black people, and half of them, they'll be on the custodial staff. And, you know, you might have somebody, he washes the windows every other Thursday. And yes, we are all about inclusion. Other folks who dialed in, if you have a hand up, line should be open. Proceed.
Can I be heard?
Greetings, retired firefighter, believe a HBCU grad.
Yes, sir. I attended two historical black colleges, Langston University and Grambling State University. And neither one of those institutions, and I graduated from both of them, neither one of those institutions, there was a class that stated that we will prepare you for white people in the workplace. I don't think I ever heard of such a class in no institution. The problem with white people is the global system of racism and white supremacy. And I don't think, logically speaking, that someone who benefits from being a white person in a world of that is dominated by the system of racism and white supremacy would have a class on how to dismantle such a position. It is something, and I'm basing it on with me personally, on something that I had to learn myself. I've always heard of that particular statements that quote-unquote historical black colleges don't prepare black students for dealing with white people in the workplace, so therefore I'm not going to attend there, or I'm going to leave and whatever. But at the same time, I've never heard of no institution, unless somebody can tell me different. And, you know, being that this is workplace racism, maybe somebody can tell me of a institution that has such a subject matter in their curriculum. I would be very, very interested in such. But that's basically my observation on that particular subject. I've been hearing that, and I finished from Grambling. That was the latter school that I attended. I finished from there in December of 1980. And I haven't heard an answer that made any sense to me on that subject. Thank you.
Much obliged, retired firefighter in Florida. I was thinking, like, man, I have not heard of such a class either anywhere, how to deal with white people in the workplace. I was thinking, though, that sounds like a great class. Like, man, they should get that on the curriculum. Like, somebody.
I would agree.
Make that a class. I would love to audit it or whatever. But I mean, man, like I don't know if that's remedial thinking or what, but I would think like that should have been one of the first classes established. Like, man, like we should have whole lots of
folks,
like how to deal with white people in the workplace. Like that is mandatory. Anybody before you graduate from business school, HBCU, even if you're in the, if you go to Howard for art history, you still got to take how to deal with white people in the workplace, because you might want to become an owner of an art museum or art gallery or something one day, or you might need to sell some of your artwork, and then wham and see. So everybody, you have to take how to like that. I don't know. That seems, unless, as he was saying, unless white people would not allow a class like that. Now that could be the case too, but I mean, we should get cracking on that. How to deal with white people in the workplace 101 and make it a class.
But at the same time, in employment, it may have changed over the years, but in employment, when I was coming out of college and when I first started in on my career job, the majority of non-white black people that was in professional positions that required a college degree went to historical black colleges. They didn't go to Florida State or Florida. Now that may have, I don't know if that have changed. I don't know if it's changed anything, but I'm sure it still is a lot of young people who are on jobs working that required a college quote unquote education that still attended these historical black colleges. A high percentage when it comes to non-white black people, I would say, still, whatever that profession is.
I believe that is the case. They train even Dr. Welsing. Hey, they trained a lot of folks to go out and do things, constructive things in the world. And maybe they have such a class, and maybe it's just under a different name, or we just, you know, haven't found it yet. But if it does exist, let's get the syllabus. If it doesn't exist, let's get cracking working on that. Because I was even thinking of, like, what would be in the curriculum? Like, what would such a class cover? I was thinking it's so much, like, oh, so much. I was even thinking, like, you go into the history of black people being mistreated in the workplace, which is important. And then I would think, hopefully, real world application on things to do, things to not do, recording laws, that type of thing. Like lots of different things. Yes. Class on how to deal with white people in the workplace, so that we'll have no more Chad Sanders, no other black females, black males saying, man, I was graduated, was not prepared for white people in the workplace, and was poorly adjusted to whiteness, racism, white people. Let's see. I'll get in some more emails as we proceed. Let's see. I don't say that I'm well adjusted to white people myself. They practice racism. I would just use different phrasing. They practice racism, white supremacy. So you have to be very cautious when you are around them, and try to minimize the time that you are going to be around them. Be strategic for those periods of time. That's the way it would have to be thought about. Other emails. Victim wrote in, social media. Don't we talk about this regularly? I recently received an extensive email, 8-page printed document from my employer regarding the new social media policy, which was distributed to all coworkers. A few of the things that got my attention. One, if I post something on any social media platform and anyone complains to the corporation about it, I have a problem. Even if there is nothing in the post identifying the employer or that I am employed by them, if someone reports it back to my employer, I have a problem. Man, I have to stop here just so I don't forget. Now, Dr. Kanban has said for a long time this rule shouldn't apply to you at all, because I've been saying for a decade you shouldn't be on social media unless you have a job. Some of our Cows listeners, Mr. Steele and some other folks, you have a job where you have to have a social media presence as a part of your duties, your career. Fine. You, and even at the New York Times, somebody, just a white man, just lost his job for his social media conduct, saying Negro online and such. Anyway, even if that's the case, I would be super codified about what I say, what I don't say, what I post. Like, oh man, having that in mind, anyone in the universe could be looking at this. And I have a problem. So it would be very strategic if I have to have this platform as a part of my job. If it's not a requirement, I'm not on social media. If you need what they call a burner account, I just need a throwaway so I can get on, want to, you know, say my 2 cents about this here film, or, you know, call somebody a coon or whatever it is, fine, but it's not under my name. I am not friends or connected in any way with anyone that I work with. I even say that for non-white people. Like, these are not my friends or homies or whatever. I'm not taking any chances with some lame post that I had on Instagram, and now I got to come in and waste all my time and worry about being fired because of some nonsense on Instagram 5 years ago. Like, come on. The other side, though, all of that notwithstanding, hopefully if you're a Cows listener, you have an extra strong social media counter-racist code by now. The other side, why I found this even more intriguing, we have our caller at the courthouse in Florida. He's been doing recon. I just said, the white woman posted that image and said, my authentic self, and it was a devil. Boom, put that in the workplace folder. I was thinking, oh man, that type of thing. I mean, he had images of them posting firearms and all kinds of things. Like, ooh, wee. You could just be sent. Becky has some disturbing social media posts that I think we should be made aware of. And, oh, my Lord, you could cause all kinds of problems. Like, do recon. Like, if your friend, or I won't even say friends, people that you work with, if they're on social media and they come and, you know, come over here, Michael, come look at my social media. Look at us. We got this post. We were out last night having a blast. Look at us. We were acting like Dave Chappelle. Isn't that fun? Uh-huh. And you just write down what they're, oh, okay, they're on Instagram at, you know, another one or whatever, you know, their code and all that stuff. And just write it down. Oh, okay, I'll go check them out. Sometimes you can even check, it might just be under their name, right, on Twitter or Facebook or whatever. Go check them out. See what they're writing about you. These might be folks who were bragging and they got pictures of them at the Capitol. Man, I'm stomping on Nancy Pelosi's catalog it in your workplace racism file. Number two, they reserve the right to use software and blog tools to monitor social media posts. In other words, coworker, you are being watched. I cannot emphasize enough, I would not be on social media, not under my name. It would have to be some ridiculous, you know, pseudonym, Alfalfa Sprouts Forever, like something just really wild and lame that no connection to you at all. You don't have any identifying information, no pictures. If you just gotta have it, if you want to follow some other people and get information, that sort of thing, fine. But I mean, you are being, and you certainly are not checking social media on the job. Even if it's on your like personal phone, I still wouldn't be on it, because racists are so nosy. They'll do the look over your shoulder and see if I can find your handle and all that. Like, no checking social media in the workplace, even on your private device, and certainly not on the company's machine. Number three, coworkers are encouraged. Oh my God. Oh my Lord. Coworkers are encouraged to report on each other if they identify anything which they think may be problematic. They have a system in which reporting can be done, supposedly, anonymously. Oh my God. Now, we read George Orwell, 1984, like, That's what I just said. I would not even check social media if you have it on the work site. Like, not at all. I don't have it. I'm good. I let all that go. And it wouldn't even stand out. You can say you're with all the other folks. You got upset. Mark Zuckerberg and those folks, they don't value privacy. I don't trust them with my data. I chucked it all. And they said, oh, right on. I'm with you, brother. They would say, that's like, I'm not on any of that. I don't do any of that. I would not have any of that attached to my name. Like, in this sort, and they will be looking. They'll be looking at you like, oh, yeah. I remember we had that Opa-locka 3. I bet he's got some revolutionary social media account with the Black Lives Matter and all the rest. Like, nothing, absolutely nothing on social media. Let's see. Other folks who, much obliged for dialing in, got to have a very solid social media counter-racist code for 2021 and beyond. Other folks who dialed in with a hand up, star or 720-716-7300, the code 564-943-pound. Press star 61 if you would like to participate.
Can I be heard?
Emmy, had great yoga this morning, used my singing bowl, was awesome. Hope you all are safe out in the Commonwealth. Namaste.
Namaste, you guys. I'm very happy to hear that you had a great class. I did not do yoga today, but I did do a very intense cardio to release all my endorphins before I come to work tonight. So I'm feeling pretty great. And greetings to all of the callers. I hope everyone is doing well. For the first, thank you for sharing the first segment of the show. For some folks who don't know, if you either have a Kindle or have like an Android or an iPhone and you get the Kindle app, you can always sample a book for free. So before I left the house, I did download a sample of his book because I'm interested. And, you know, sometimes you can see if you're going to like the writing style or the content, look at the table of contents, see what else is included. So I'm going to check out the sample tonight while I'm at work. I did not go to an HBCU. I did major in African American studies. I double majored in gender, sexuality, and women's studies, and I minored in religious studies. So I said all of that to say I spent a lot of time in the humanities, but I was very fortunate that my very first class, my very first AFAM class, was Intro to African American Studies, and it was taught by a professor who later got fired because of his level of direct authenticity with his students. I was very fortunate to be able to take the class, his last class before he got fired. And, I mean, of course, depending on a person's sensitivities, whatever. But so he did not prepare me to be with and amongst people classified as white or in a racist environment, but he was very blunt about how people classified as white see us, because the class was majority black, and he lost his job. And to this day, I still hold him in very high regard for his level of honesty. I think workplace racism is a fantastic substitute for the lack of having a class to prepare us to be in predominantly white spaces or white workplaces. I think since we don't have a class, this actually functions as my class. I've learned so much participating in workplace racism. I was very grateful that he did not allow that woman classified as white to pivot away from something she said she would come back to. I don't know if the conversation they had was longer than what we were able to hear on the broadcast, but earlier she mentioned that she would get to the entrepreneurship, but she never directly asked him about it. And right towards the end, he brought it up again. And I just find that very subtle tactic, very manipulative and destructive, especially if you're trying to say something and maybe reach an audience, maybe me, you know, if you were trying to. I may or may not be an entrepreneur. I don't really know right now. Right now, I'm just still trying to get my credentials and licensing. But after that, I may open my own practice. But he, that was his point. So it didn't, in my opinion, it doesn't matter what the non-white person's point is, but that they're able to express that point and not allow people classified as white to keep us trapped in an emotional circle of dialogue, or a circle of dialogue that's just centered and focused on a lot of emotion and not being able to get to what it is you actually want to say to people who might hear your message. So he very tactfully brought it back and said what he wanted to say. And I just thought that that was, for me, something that I'm always paying attention to. You know, they're always like, we'll get to that later, or yeah, we'll bring that up later. And it never happens. And you just get forced into having the type of conversation they want you to have instead of the conversation that you want to have. I do think it's important because just like we say on the broadcast that white people don't care about children, I think I'm coming to the, I've already come to the conclusion that white people also don't have a relationship with the Creator or care about having an authentic relationship with the Creator. The evidence is stark and overwhelming that their idol, their God, their most important thing is maintaining the system of white supremacy and themselves, not anything else. In which case, when he said faith, although he didn't put it in a religious context, and I'm not doing that either, that's something that to me definitely separates people classified as white and those of us classified as non-white and specifically Black. That ability to go beyond what you can see in front of you and still move forward. I think if we had made any progress, which I'm not claiming that we have, I can say for myself from where I was to where I am, a lot of that had to do with my ability to believe in what I couldn't see and keep going despite what's in front of me. And I thought that was, because he said, she asked the question and he said, oh, that's easy faith. I just wanted to highlight that because to me that's very important. It could be that I'm just really on my own spiritual journey. I will be transparent about that. And it's just making the difference for me, even in my workplace, being able to say a prayer before I come in here, to center myself before I get here, to make sure I stay grounded and professional, and I stay elevated and not allow anyone to pull me into anything that I'm not agreeing to be pulled into. In another way, I just won't let you make me negative or pull me out of character. I don't have children, but I work with children. And I think I'm still very much in touch with my child self. So it's one of the reasons I think I'm successful working with the children that I work with, particularly the non-white ones. And my experience with non-white children is that they're able to perceive even the things that white children cannot. And so I don't believe in, and I've expressed on the show the conversations I have with the non-white kids that I work with about racism, white supremacy, and how they're being viewed and will be viewed, what they won't be allowed to get away with and what white children will be allowed to get away with, and how they'll need to navigate their lives so that they make choices to, you know, get out of this facility and never return. And they're perceptive. Even at 7, 8, 9, super, super, super intelligent and able to communicate. Of course, like I think Gus said in the last broadcast, you do tailor your language, but do not believe in not having those difficult conversations with little children, because especially if they're Black, number one, it's for their safety, you know, especially about inappropriate touching or when someone is mistreating you, being able to ask and for help, to be able to recognize who you can ask for help. And I think non-white children as the Mr. Carson, or Dr. Carson, I'm not sure, but I think his name is Carson. Anywho, that he was saying that Black children actually, we learn these things at a very early age. In my experience, we do. So at the facility that I work, there is she's turning 8 tomorrow, actually. And she and I talk very directly. She engages in headbanging and lots of maladaptive, self-destructive behaviors, but she only does it with certain staff. None of the Black staff have this problem with her every now and then. But for the most part, she does not do it with us. And I talk to her, and she is able to
Emmy, did we lose you? Might have dropped, her signal might have dropped out. I will keep an eye out for her on the switchboard if she dials back in so that we can get her back on the line. She's talking about this young lady with some sort of difficult, or it seems like select difficulties with some of the staff, with some self-harming behaviors. I'll look out for her as soon as I get her back on the switchboard, then we will get her back on the line. I'll give out the number again while we wait a moment. 720-716-7300. The code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. I'll get the other folks who dialed in. I'll just give a second or so for Emmy to see if we can get her back so we can kind of complete the thought. If not, we'll nab some of the other folks and then hopefully we can pick her back up as we... Oh, there we go. Didn't have to wait too long. All right. Are you back with us, Emmy? We lost you. You were talking about the young lady with the self-harming behaviors with some of the staff.
And I just have to say thank you so much. And thank you, everyone, for your patience. I am actually parked with full bars and still lost the call. That is how I know, you know, it's sometimes it's just not what you see. That's all I can say, you know. But anyway, back to the little girl. I walked in and they were just talking trash about her. She's our only Black girl. She's actually probably the darkest skinned person in the facility. But I don't know how to say it, but she just does not do this with me. We talk all the time. Like, she's super independent, super intelligent, super capable, witty, funny, smart, fit, like just so many things. You know, she has everything going for her. And they're just like, she's crazy and she's this and she's that. I pulled her out one day and we talked and I asked her if she was crazy and she told me no. And I said, then, you know, you got to come up with a coping. So we did all of this work. She even brought up her coping skill prior to having a behavior, you know, told the staff that she had spoken with me and came up with a coping skill that she would do prior to being triggered. This is how capable and present and not crazy this little girl is. Some children you talk to and their eyes are staring way over there. They have no idea what you're talking about and can't follow you from point A to point B. Like, we're not even talking about B, you know, like we're just not connecting at all. So before she got triggered, she, you know, declared her coping skill, got triggered, did her coping skill, and then had a great night. That is how I know how much she's capable. This is the first child that I've worked with here who's been able to do that. That's how intelligent she is. But the white staff here want to keep making her just everything negative. And I won't allow it. I refuse. I talk to her all the time. But I think that that's true for most non-white children, specifically the Black children, that we are light years ahead of our white counterparts at every single age, at every single stage, in terms of our intellectual, psychological, and even spiritual capabilities. And white staff do, not just staff, but people in general, debilitate that. So I feel my responsibility as an adult is to communicate and to not place those small expectations or low expectations on Black children. I just absolutely refuse. No, white children, you can't talk to them, whatever. They lose their mind. They don't know what's going on. That's a whole nother thing. But my experience with Black children is you can talk to them. I know last broadcast, we talked a bit about like talented and gifted. I don't remember the context of how it was brought up, but I was in talented and gifted for the majority of my life. Did IB programs, AP programs, all of that. But I had a talented and gifted teacher. Like, I don't remember. I just remember we would get pulled out of class and we would have like our tag time, I guess. And he was a Black male, and he left a tremendous impression on me, teaching me all kinds of things and just really being in my corner and even teaching me things about like a pendulum, you know, like, and I, of course, I was, sixth grade, so I probably didn't even understand what was happening until I got much older. But I remember holding like a string with metal and him having me hold it over my hand and actually feel, you know, when it locks into your energetic vibrations, you know, if you're into that. But just things like that. So he broadened my horizons. So I don't remember, like I said, I do apologize. I don't remember the context, but, you know, I'm a huge advocate for pushing non-white children, setting high expectations, not John Henryism per se, but I believe in you. I make intense eye contact and I'll even like put my hands on your shoulder like, I see you, I believe in you. The last thing I wanted to say is I remember when I moved into the United States, I lived in Germany, I came here and I moved to, you know, a place in Virginia. And I, like I told you, I had always been in AP, IB, all of this. So I get to the school and I am in 10th grade and they're trying to put me in quote unquote regular classes. Nothing wrong with that. That's just not where I was. And then they kind of slipped in this thing about something called governor school. And I said, you know, well, what is that? And, oh, no, you don't want to do that. And it was this ugly white male, balding, overweight, just ill. And you don't want to do that. Like, that's really hard. You'd have to apply. And plus, you know, there it's like super, you know, he just said everything to try to turn me away from it. And I said, I don't, you know, to the, it's something like, I don't really understand why you're doing that. All I've ever done is AP and IB. That's pretty much what I'm going to do. And he, and this was like a conversation. My mother just sat there and he and I went back and forth to the point that, you know, and I am much calmer now. I try. Hopefully y'all can hear my voice that I try. But I pretty much at that time did not have the level of couth and tact that I have now. I said, I don't even know why you're still standing here. Give me the application. And I, that was at what, like 15? And that man had to go run and get my application. And I applied right then. And even then when I applied, they still, because it's a gifted program, Thompson gifted program based in technology. So the schools are like technologically based and super STEM and IT and whatever. They tried to not almost let me in because my writing was more creative and less research based. Then made me have to do all, and at that time I moved in, I think, to the school about a month and a half into the year. They made me do all the work for all four classes before, you know, while I'm still doing the work that they're giving me, and made me teach myself algebra too. So I say that to say that always encourage the non-white children to stand up for themselves, do that talented and gifted. I don't care about a dyslexic thing or you're not like scientific enough. I've gotten that stuff and just I'm not for any of it. I believe in the talented and gifted, the IB, the AP, all of that. And, yeah, I'm just going to let it be there. So I thank you all for listening to me. Oh, the last thing, sorry, about being prepared for all white spaces. Yeah, no, I think it's not for me to extrapolate what he said, but what I gathered from what he said is that wasn't prepared to be the only black person in the room and what that feels like, is to feel that inadequacy or that collusion that happens when you're not around. It's stark and it makes anybody depressed, especially when you are capable and you know these white people are talking about you and looking down on you. Moving into the next phase of my career, I'm already expecting that and preparing for that. But I think that's also part of the spiritual journey thing. You really have to build yourself up and do that mirror work, do that confidence work. And really understand the system of racism, white supremacy, so you don't get caught up in the nonsense, because they will definitely try you. So I hope everyone is well. Thank you all for listening to me, and thank you all for your patience with my service. Thanks.
Much obliged. Emmy, let us know. She got the Kindle download of Mr. Sanders' Black Magic, What Black Leaders Learned from Trauma and Triumph. Let us know, or I guess he, since he's talking to some other black people too, if they have any tidbits that we can incorporate. The young lady who you work with, these white women, like we said tacky before, like to have these white women sitting around and like talking trash about her. That's just like, so talk about uncouth, like, man, what in the world? Like, why not some sympathy, or let's get a plan and try to keep her safe? No, just sit around. Ah, oh, she's crazy. Ah. What in the world? Like, what, Dr. Welsing, when you play around with sex, joke is on the offspring. And I mean, white people don't care about children. They really do not care about black girls and black boys. But that is spectacular, just to be able to reach out to this young lady and get a plan for her to be safe and to encourage her. Like, man, that is obviously, she's not going to get that from the white staff members. They're sitting around cracking jokes about her and all the rest of it. I mean, and we had talked that the context where it came up about the talented and young black children not being encouraged, promoted to these talented classes and AP classes, that sort of thing. It came up. We were talking about the whole Black History Month, and the parent that wrote in, she was saying that there's a racist teacher in her son's class and that he was absent. I guess he was, I don't know where he was, but he was gone for like a month or something. I guess she didn't know where he was either. That wasn't explained what he was doing, but he wasn't in class for like a month or so. And during that time, her son flourished and he got like Scholar of the Week or something for doing really well. And I said, man, if he didn't have that racist teacher, he would have probably had like 50 of them at this point. And I said, that report, we're just not nourished to be brilliant and scholars. We have our guardians and educators are sitting around and cracking jokes on us and talking bad about us. And then they go and talk about how young TJ is the smartest and fairest and most intelligent young man we've ever seen in the world. And then they come and tell you to hush up and you can't read, to go sit in the corner. You know, we might need to get you in the remedial class or something. That was the context that it came up. But that sort of encouragement that you gave to this young lady is so missing for so many young black children. That makes such a huge impact. White people, educators know this. Even that getting a second chance, where it's not as soon as you say one thing, like immediately, like, you're suspended for the next 5 days and all the rest of it, or you're going to be in school suspension or something else, where she said just being able to give some encouragement, give them a rub on the shoulder in a non-Jeffrey Epstein way, some support, black self-respect. You are brilliant. You can do it. It'll be hard, but you are more than capable. Dr. Welsing used to give that type of encouragement, like very missing for a lot of young black scholars, especially having race soldiers, you know, for educators. Let's see. Other folks who dialed in that we missed totally. If you have a hand up, line should be open. Proceed.
Are you able to hear me, Gus?
Mr. Reed, yes, sir.
Hello?
We can hear you, Mr. Reed. Hello, we can hear you.
Okay, good evening to you and all the listeners. Yes, thank you. Greetings to everybody. I do have an update from the education situation from yesterday, but real quick, some of the things that were brought up. I am what you might call an entrepreneur, meaning that I don't have a boss. But people are exactly right. That doesn't matter if you run your own business or if you work for somebody else. When it comes to social media and people trying to have you canceled, certainly white people have tried to have Black Talk Media Project canceled for talking about, asking questions about whether or not former political candidate, presidential candidate Hillary Clinton was correct to do this, that, or the other. And then all of a sudden, our bank account is being audited by the IRS, along with, you know, a whole bunch of other organizations that was being targeted as so-called, you know, Russian dupes or working on the behalf of Putin or something. I have no doubt in my mind that's where that was the origin or the reason that, although the IRS never notified me, it was the bank manager that notified me, and I never talked to the IRS. They went through my account and never heard from them again. And they didn't tell her why they were going through my account. So I just kind of like, you know, put two and two together. And that's what I strongly suspect it was. Also here recently doing activities as the Black Talk Media Project in its mission to elevate black voices. I bought a PA system for these young people that were organizing and marching and protesting and having town halls surrounding, or it was sparked off by the murder of George Floyd. So I started going to these events, organizing these events for the young people so that it would be organized and not just a bunch of people standing on the street yelling and screaming, you know, and also organizing teach-ins and then also sponsoring voter registration, you know, booths and stuff at different little local businesses in the area. And so everything was all well and fine. And Black Talk Media Project is doing a good job until my daughter and myself start talking about the issue of transgender women and women and girls sports. And my daughter, who is a former track athlete, said that, no, that is not the same thing as a woman as I am. I bleed every month. When I was running track, I had my period, and trans women, XY chromosome, do not bleed. Then all of a sudden, oh, we're the scourge. We're starting to be attacked by all of these white, not black, but white LGBT people going all through my social media, trying to find anything that they could find that they could label transphobic, homophobic, you know, whatever phobia, which I assured them I have no irrational fear of anything or anyone. I'm totally rational in my thoughts and using logic in noting that double X chromosomes and XY chromosomes are very, very different. There's no way they can be the same. All right. So moving on. So it doesn't matter if you run your own business or not. Social media can be haphazard for you if you're not careful. Moving on, giving you an update. I did talk to my daughter, who unfortunately, she's a single mother. The father's around, but he's not actively involved in the child's life. So I got her permission to make up this list, as was suggested last week, with these different words like racism, sexism, all these different words and what have you. I then talked to my other daughter and her ex-husband, but they still work together to co-parent, and talked to both of them at the same time. And they also agreed that I could educate them, you know, with that word list. Going back to, I mentioned last week, the reading comprehension exercises. During February, they was talking about Thomas Jefferson, George Washington. Those are the ones that I saw because I happened to be helping him that day. So yesterday I'm helping him, and it's talking about the study. It's talking about these transparent frogs. I don't know if it's a newly discovered species. I think it's a newly discovered species, and how they can help doctors develop, you know, medical care by being able to study the organs of these frogs, right? And so that's what the whole essay was about. And then it asked, what, 9 questions that's related. And sometimes it'll pull excerpts from the essay. And then the student, again, mind you, this is a 10-year-old, fourth grade, and he is on the ICP plan. What that means here in Gaston County is he has been medically diagnosed with a mild case of autism. Okay. So just want to tell you, this is my oldest grandson, right? But it don't affect him socially or anything. He's good in math. He's good with technology. Always has been a good reader. So I don't want to make it seem like he has some kind of disability or something. That's what they said, that he has a slight touch of autism, been diagnosed. So he's supposed to be on this ICP plan, which basically means he needs more time sometimes to complete his projects, and that sometimes if you don't know how to engage him, his attention span will be short. Okay. So anyway, I'm helping him with this. And then I'm reading these words, and I had said, mentioned this to my mother. I mentioned it to his mother, and I brought it up with my other daughter and her husband, about her ex-husband, about I'm not sure that they're giving him fourth grade reading stuff. It's got words in here like hepatologist in other words, that I have to look up. And that's what we did. And if I wasn't, if it was nobody around to help him, he would be totally lost. And this, the context and the way these essays are written is more along seventh grade. And now that I know it's a white female teacher, this is, you know, a new teacher, white female teacher. Now, you know, I'm really suspicious and what have you. She could be giving him work that's not even on his grade level, and then giving the other children work that's on their grade level. Other family members have expressed concern about this one particular white teacher. So to wrap it up, yesterday my daughter tells me that, now I don't advocate giving children fast food. Again, this is a single mother doing the best she can to raise her child. And she works a lot. If I can say anything about my oldest daughter, she is a worker. She will work, and she's never without a job. And so she had to drop him off at school a little late for whatever reason. So she buys him some McDonald's. So I don't advocate fast food for children, okay? But she buys him what she buys him. She drops him. She gets permission from the school principal for him to eat his breakfast in the classroom with the other children that's eating their breakfast, right? So she gets that permission. She sends him into the school. The teacher, he tells the teacher what his mother told him to tell her, that he has permission from the office, from the principal, to eat his McDonald's for breakfast. So this teacher tells him, basically calls him a liar and saying she doesn't believe him. So he doesn't know how to react to that. Then she sends him to go eat somewhere off by himself and not let him in the class because she don't allow fast food in her classroom. So my daughter calls me again. I'm talking to my daughter. She's very upset. She's a very passionate person, very upset, especially if she think you mistreating her or her child. So she calls me very passionate, you know, speaking loudly, whatever. So she asked me my advice, and I said, calm down. I said, before you call this woman, before you text this woman, you calm down, wait a couple of hours. This isn't something that has to be handled within 24 hours. Calm down, then write your thoughts down about what occurred, what your son told you, what you talk all the details about you talking to the principal and whatnot, and your questions about, this woman can text you at any time of the day, but she didn't text you to see if Micah had permission, that's my grandson's name, to eat his breakfast in your classroom. And your classroom, what, you're above the rules? Your classroom trump what the principal says, the administrator says, who runs the school. So I said, write all of that down. Then you want to refine it, whittle it down so you're not using a bunch of buckets of words, which is a phrase I learned on the cows. And then, you know, you send that to the principal. But she didn't send it to the principal. She calmed down, asked the teacher questions. Then the teacher texted her, which I thought text is better than voice because now she has a screenshot of these tests. So she's asking this teacher questions primarily about, why did you make my son? I felt like you mistreated my son by insinuating he was a liar and then sending him off to eat by himself. So she doesn't even address that in a return text. She just talks about, oh, it's my classroom, my rules. So I said, now you got a text. Now you go to the principal. So I think she handled that the right way. I suspect this woman of practicing racism. And another thing that occurred to me last thing is that since we have been active in our county and people know our names and we and our pictures have been in the papers, and I've even written editorials and that were published in addressing racism and white supremacy in this county. And I remember someone last week said, like I told my daughter, the reason you want to calm down, because they will use the angry black woman label on you if you're not calm when you speak to them. And what have you, and it's better to do the text. So anyway, I remember somebody say, well, they might try to mistreat your grandson if you go up there and you the angry black guy and you're all passionate, and even that might be your normal manner of speaking, you want to calm it down. And so I started thinking, this ain't that big of a county. It ain't that many people with our last names in this county. And, you know, I suspect that this white woman might be targeting my grandson because of our activism in the paper against racism and white supremacy. So just to end it, I have taken up them suggestions, great suggestions from last week, and we will start their counter racist education at 10, 9, and 10 years old. Thank you.
Oh, well, that's spectacular. Spectacular. Yeah, I remember he said he was going to talk to his grandchildren's parents and get the approval. Like, I think Emiya just said, like, these young people, they are brilliant. They can understand lots, especially if it's hanging out with their grandfather or their grandmother or mom, dad, whoever it is, somebody that they have a genuine relationship. You've been hanging out with them and you all go out, kick it, have fun, all that stuff. Like, absolutely. Just explain it to them. Or if you're going to use new terms, you said you got your sheet of words. Bam, you go over and have definitions. They've been in school. They do that. They know what it is to look up terms. They've seen a dictionary before. Super easy. And I mean, if they're 9, 10, they have probably already seen and heard a lot about things that are in fact, even the whole breakfast situation. I mean, you want to talk about tacky. You're a lot like that's something that you can't confirm. I'm coming in. I mean, a lot of times you have a note or something from the office, or if you're coming in late to verify that, yes, this person has checked in. They, you know, talk to whoever they're supposed to talk to, the principal's office or whatever, to, yes, okay, let's get to class. That can't be verified. You can't pick up the phone really quick just to check in at the office. Did this fella get verification to bring this McDonald's? Oh, okay, right on. No, it's just assumed you're a liar and you're going to be banished to the dungeon because we do not, like, what? And that's how I get to start my day, like banishment and I'm a liar. Not, let me investigate. Why is it even assumed that I'm a liar? Not that I'm telling the truth, just to come in and eat. Woof. We just, Mothers of Massive Resistance, she had a lot about North Carolina in that book. And white women leading the charge against school integration. It was all of that. White women leading the charge against having black students in school. We do not want these little black guys in here with our white daughters. And then she even tied it up to today and saying that they switched and then joined the school system to target mostly young, like your grandson, young black males, prison pipeline. Oh, they're aggressive and loud, and angry, and militaristic, and all the rest of them. Like, very nicely, Dr. Elizabeth Elizabeth Gillespie McCray, Mothers of Massive Resistance. North Carolina is one of the feature states in that report. But I mean, that is so disgusting. I would just say that is spectacular. I can switch now. Parenting effort, because now you were talking to your daughter and telling her to calm down. That's what we talk about for workplace racism every week. That is number one. You have to maintain your composure. If you can't stay calm and kind of manage your emotions, nothing else matters. And it is exactly this game. If you're talking a school situation and you're a parent having to advocate for your offspring or child, whatever it is, or if you're in the workplace situation, you really want to make sure that it's not just, you know, you letting your emotions kind of get the best of you and got what you say, what words you choose. As he said, brilliant. This doesn't have to be a right now. In the next 5 seconds, you have to respond. Like, calm down and just breathe. Let's get your heart rate back down. Sit. Once you feel like you can speak normal, and just write it down. What's important? What question? Why is my son assumed to be a liar? Excellent question. Just go through. What questions do I want answered about this situation? And I think Emmy and some of our other folks have been big advocates of doing it. Some form of electronic communication, text, email. That way you have an immediate record. There's not going to be a he said, she said, and I didn't say that. I don't remember that. And nope, time stamped, all of that. This is what you said. And you got the answers to your questions if you need to, you know, talk to somebody else or what have you. But great recommendation to take time. You might even need a day if you are really upset and it takes you a while to kind of get it together. People should be upset about their children being treated this. I mean, I'm coming in. This is not, we got, you know, $1,000 missing and I'm coming in with, you know, new Nikes every day. Like, that's not what this is. I'm just coming in to eat my breakfast and I'm assumed to be a liar. Like, what in the world? Like, that we just talked about black children. They don't end up in the gifted programs. They don't get support. You're not allowed to fail up. I'm not even allowed to come in class where the principal has already given me the okay. No. I'm still subject for punishment. That's why it's so much to think about. If you're going to be an attempted parent, it's so much to process. Like, this is what is waiting for my child. This is what is waiting for my grandchild. What's going to be our plan to make sure that this type of thing doesn't happen? Might even be retaliation. They find out we got grandparents who are a little too rowdy in this area about counter-racism. Talking against gender confusion, that type of thing. We'll make sure that the whole family pays. We mentioned that last week. Vindictive, that was the word for last week. Vindictive, they are vindictive. They will look for payback against you. Sometimes your whole family, that does happen. Man, sorry to hear that. That is atrocious, Mr. Reed, but I'm glad young fella had some strong advocates to look out for him. Man, that... I'm sure that will probably continue, though. I've said that when you have those type of situations, generally speaking, the vindictive, they will hold vendettas for the rest of the school year. Sometimes we've heard that a few times from folks. Much obliged for the update, Mr. Reed. Let us know how it goes, sharing the information with your grandchildren, getting the word list together. Hopefully that will encourage other folks to do the same. So they can explain, because that way you'll have a vocabulary. You can explain the situation with the breakfast with your grandson so that he knows exactly how you feel, exactly how your mom feels, that this white woman was practicing racism. And they do this type of thing all the time. Assumed to be a liar. Come on. Let's see. Other folks who dialed in, if we have missed you totally. 720-716-7300, the code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. That's another great one. You can speak with your grandson and say, hey, can you think of some times where some of your white classmates, the teacher automatically assumed that they were lying? They said whatever they said. And it was just, oh, no, I don't believe you. You're lying. And bam, going through with the consequence. Like, can you think of some other times where that's happened to some of your white classmates? Or just have them pay attention. See things as they unfold in the future and see if they see that happen again. Woo, man, oh, man. Black male privilege. That's what they say. Yes, yes. Other folks who dialed in, if we missed you totally, if you have commentary to share, proceed.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Greetings, Gus. This is Buraku calling from Japan. Thank you. Greetings to you. Good morning. It's new. Good almost afternoon. And good afternoon to all the callers and listeners. I'm sorry I missed a little bit of the earlier part of the... I came in on the tail end of talking about the HBCU. Am I correct? You were talking about HBCUs and whether or not they're preparing us for entrance into the white world. Is that the question that was asked?
Yes, sir. There was an audio segment at the beginning. There's a black author, Chad Sanders, and he graduated from Morehouse. And he was doing an interview. He was talking about his workplace experience. And he said, I'm using his language. He said that he found that he was not well adjusted for whiteness, and he gave a variety of different explanations around this, and saying that he basically felt that his white colleagues, they thought of him as being not intelligent, not logical, not qualified, all the rest of it. And so he worked to try to prove them wrong, and he failed at that, and he felt sad and confused, and he felt that he hadn't been adequately prepared for a white work space. coming from that environment, Morehouse and such. Yes, that was discussed.
Oh, okay. I understand. I attended an HBCU. I went to Lincoln University. It's the first HBCU. It was in 1848. I think they what I always saw as their mission, I think retired firefighters spoke on this, they put degrees in the hands of Black children that maybe wouldn't otherwise have gotten them. I guess they'd been doing that prior to the abolition. So, I mean, that's what I figured that was basically their biggest, the most positive thing I could say about what they were doing. They got degrees into our hands. And, you know, that being said, let me see, we had a class, I can't remember what it was called, not African American Experience, it was something, which was kind of like an orientation sort of class, our very first semester of the freshman year. It wasn't any specific class, but it was kind of like a seminar. And what I and my friends, who we thought ourselves maybe a little less confused, what we really got from the main message, if anything, trying to promote us, prepare us for the white world, was code switching. You being one way at home and being another way in the office. But not really any context to that, or even why we're doing that or anything. They're just sort of code switching and making it in the white world and so on. That was about it. They didn't contextualize at all or really identify our problems, or there wasn't anything really codified about the behavior. They didn't tell us what to do in this situation, repair us for anything. There was no practical advice. Just kind of, I don't know, code switching, you can interpret that lots of ways. Someone who's more codified would interpret it somewhere a lot different, I think, than someone who could interpret it a different way. It sounds almost like, you know, kind of go along to get along or something. And I remember, yeah, so I didn't feel that. Where I really felt unprepared by that school, my school experience, I didn't go to work directly from there, but after I graduated from there with my bachelor's, I got accepted into a master's program at University of Pittsburgh, and that was a shock. I felt culture shock there, and that was an incredible experience. I mean, going there, and I mean, you know, I was studying Asian languages, and I had an Asian teacher, a Chinese woman, who was kind of, but she was in a tragic arrangement. And so she was a little conflicted. She saw what I was going through because I don't know what to say. I mean, the head of the program, you know, the head of the program there, you know, I became sort of friendly with her son, and her son even told me one time, you know, the problem with my mom is she doesn't understand that there's a difference between Black people and niggers. I mean, forget about his statement and that whole Chris Rock thing, but that's who was supposed to be looking out for me, the woman who didn't see a difference between black people and niggers. And also, as victims, you know, even the victims that were running the school, you know, my undergraduate, academically, I wasn't prepared to go, you know, I didn't have what my white classmates had. I wasn't on a level with them as far as, you know, I might have had the brains and the talent and all of that, but I didn't have the training and, you know, the academic know-how that everyone else had. That was a big problem. And I felt that, you know, there was enough soul and a lot of, you know, I don't know what you want to call it. We had a lot of soul, hand clapping and, you know, singing, and which I'm not taking away from that, but we didn't have a lot of practical skills and so on in our schools. We had a lot of white teachers in the HBCU too. And so I could see why the school couldn't take a more, you know, militant stance as far as who we were as Black people and so on, though they might have in the past. Actually, Lincoln University was graduated Kwame Nkrumah and graduated Nnamdi Azikiwe, the first presidents of revolutionary presidents of of Ghana and Nigeria. But I think that was kind of pre Thurgood Marshall, pre integration and so on. Now I think black people had a different mindset. And from what I had heard from older alumni, people who were in their 60s and 70s, it was a much different place at that time. So they might have at that time prepared you, you know, when we were kind of had our, I don't know how to, don't want to use a metaphor, but backs up against the wall, so to speak, when we were under greater pressure and you know, in a segregationist time. But not quite preparing. I felt unprepared in many ways. And I didn't, again, not in the workplace, but in going on to school later. And I've gone through all of those emotions that this gentleman you just mentioned, the, you know, confused, not understanding why I wasn't as good as everyone else, wanting to show, but also some sort of resentment and wanting to retreat into myself. I went through the whole gamut of those emotions. So I understand that completely. So that's kind of a summation of my experience at an HBCU. And I'll mute my line. Thank you very much to you, Gus, and all the callers and listeners.
Much obliged, sir. Wow. Saturday in Japan. I fear maybe 1,000 years from now, hopefully white supremacy racism will be vanquished, but 1,000 years from now, beings will look back and they'll sift through the ruins and wreckage from this era, if we survive the Rona, and they'll say, wow, the preeminent critical race theorist of the late 20th and early 21st century was Chris Rock. And I'll have no means to refute them at all. To be like, wow, he's quoted by everybody. He had everything to say about racism. Like, woo, man, oh man. That is fast. As I said, I didn't go to an HBCU, so I can't speak from direct experience, but I guess I'm not surprised that they didn't have a class per se to prepare you on dealing with white people in a corporate environment type of a thing. I've heard that from other black students who said that they felt like many of the white students.
Your audio is going out, Gus.
Oh, am I being heard? Am I being heard?
See, it's very clear just then.
Okay. Much obliged. Yes, I have heard that from other black people, students who said they felt like their white counterparts in their same class and everything seemed way more prepared. And I can't speak to that, even though I don't have the HBCU experience feeling the same thing. I remember one of my classmates, I think his father was like a really white classmate. His white father was like a really prominent pediatrician. And we had to do like some science project, and it was just like, oh, wow. Yeah, his dad is a doctor. He could probably come and teach this class. Like, it just seemed like they were many, not all of them, but it did seem like many of them just had access to way more resources and were way more prepared in many respects. That's what you would expect from the system of white supremacy. I didn't have the reasoning as to why that was at the time. I think our caller in Japan, he was saying about the same experience of the confusion, sadness that can go with all of that, feeling like you're being looked down upon by your white colleagues. I guess the only thing I would add to that is it doesn't really matter. You could be like super qualified valedictorian and you would get the same exact treatment. Like, that's really making sure we understand the system of racism, white supremacy. Like, it really doesn't have anything to do with whether or not you're qualified and you did your work or not, you're smart. Like, you can do all of that and it does not change their perception of you at all. What does it mean to be white? Oh, did you have...
Yes, I'm sorry, Gus. I'm sorry to interrupt. But something I meant to mention it and it slipped my mind, and this was particularly traumatic at the time. Two things. One, I because in my undergrad, my thing, I did Asian languages, And when I went to the university, they actually offered me a scholarship. I thought that because I was special. Looking back, they wanted to fulfill their quota. But I went, they brought me there, but they didn't actually have enough Asian languages to, you know, I was already past the level of what they had. So I wound up having to take a lot of, you know, like Asian politics and courses of that nature, things I had no background for. I do languages. So what happened is I took a class once, and then I, you know, early on while we were still in the, you know, you can drop the class that, that early period. I dropped the class, and then that those same advisors, the ones who don't see the difference between blacks and niggers, they asked me why. And I said, that class is really intense, really, you know, it's a heavy, it's the political science or something. It's a lot of, and it's not my area. So I told them it's a lot of work for a class that I'm really not interested in. It's not at all my area of expertise. It's not what I, so I wound up taking a lot of other, trying to apply to a lot of language classes. My, that one Chinese teacher, I said that was in a tragic arrangement, who was kind of conflicted. She tried to play both sides with us, tried to help me and tried to not get in trouble herself. But anyway, she made me privy to an email they had circulated where those same, that same woman passed, sent an email around like, watch out for this Che. We think he's getting lazy. Because he says that he dropped the class because it was, quote, and she put in quotes, too much work. And I thought, okay, this is the lazy nigger stereotype that we're going with. Okay, I see where they're going. And that same teacher told me at a later time, told me to be careful because what she had been told by those white women is that she should beware of me because I have street smarts. And, you know, so I and that's basically that there's something devious and sinister in my having street smarts in addition to book smarts or something of that. So they tried to make sure that that woman distanced herself from me. And when you know, months later, I was speaking to an uncle of mine and I recounted this story. And he said, you should have sued them on the spot right there. And when he told me that, it made perfect sense. This was already far, it was much later. And then I realized that, wow, you know, I mean, this was an uncle. This wasn't my parents. And I realized my parents also, of course, they're victims, you know, but I didn't, if I had had parents that, you know, if I had been more codified in my upbringing, let's say, you know, to be aware of those things, yeah, I would have had a much different experience. So that was also something that, looking back, you know, that those things, and I wound up never completing that program. In fact, it was years and years later before I wound up going back to school again. And Pittsburgh itself, just as a town, was a horrible experience racially. You know, I'm coming from New York. I wasn't used to being in that type of a situation. But yeah, thank you very much for letting me add that last piece, and I'll mute my line again. Thank you.
I think that might qualify as unjust networking to have white women circulating messages that we've got a lazy street smart nigra. See, that's why I said with it's always going to be something less than professed. It's not going to be scholarly, ambitious, studious, nah, militaristic. Radical, shiftless, lazy, dangerous, like those type of liar, even for the little ones, like what? And even they'll take a quote where it's going to be too much work. Well, wait a minute. I didn't say I was lazy and just wanted to be out selling cocaine in the street. I just said this is not even what I came to study. Like, this is not my interest at all. And I'd have to invest my whole life in this. It would be too much. Ah, nah, nah. Lazy. That's that. All of that gets translated. Lazy nigger. And then we tell everybody else in the butt, you got to watch out. Got to lazy. And what does that have to do with street smart? Like, he's lazy and he's wily. He might get over on us. He might fool you to where you don't think that he's a no-count, shiftless nigga. So you got to watch Chris Rock's. He ain't able to dig out between, like, what? And then wonder, he says, I didn't complete the program. Where did we start at today, even from last week? black students don't get encouragement to go into gifted programs. That's the same thing. Who would be encouraged to have the whole my whole department is sitting around talking about me as some lazy, you know, clown? I'm just here wasting time, shiftless, maybe looking to sell drugs to the students with my street smarts and all. Who wants to stay in that environment? Like, yeah, I'm gonna stick it out and be here. Yes, this makes me feel great to be in this environment. What 9-10-year-old wants to get up and go to school and be excited about learning where the teacher automatically thinks I'm a liar? Oh yeah, I can't wait to run out of bed. Like, yes, hurry up and get me to the classroom. White women. The system of racism, white supremacy does not operate without white women and white men. Racist man, racist woman, racist child. Other folks that we missed totally.
May I be heard?
Greetings, caller in Florida.
Yes, sir. Thank you very much, sir. Greetings to Gus, the host, the listeners and callers. Due to my observation in the workplace this week, discovered another interesting situation where social media came into play, I guess I could say. The victim of racism was approached by the white female that sits at the headset, right? And she was coming to tell her something that the supervisor posted on her page. Supervisor now. All right. And this female has been victimized. Now, she hasn't explained it to me, but just in her responses since like last June, like the Juneteenth picture that I shared about Gus, where she had on the dress and the white women that are in the gang, MAGA gang, two of them, I got a screenshot of them clicking on it. So shortly after that, they got into a feud about something, and definitely they took vengeance out. They came back with a vengeance against a black female, black lady. And then something happened again where she was like, I got all of them. Okay, so these was two incidents. So leading to Thursday, she said that this white woman said that she was called this black person's name on the post. So I actually went to see if I could verify this. And apparently she has, this is a public post, which meaning I don't even have to friend this person. Cause you know, I'm rarely on it. I just get on it to, as you say, to do recon. So I noticed that the supervisor was tagged in this post, and she called this white female the black female's name. So she went to go tell this victim, and she was just surprised by it, like, what's going on here? And she replies by saying, you know, I blocked all of them, using her index finger, and she waved it out to the other side, because you know the separation on skin tone on the other side of the department, the pale skin, you know, white females over there, mainly the clique members. See, I blocked all of them. Now, following logic, you got a white woman standing before you. She didn't block her though, and she's telling her this. All right. And this person is friends with those same clique girls. So logically, what's going to happen after that is she's going to go back and tell them. But see, like I said, victim. You know, it doesn't seem like she understands racism in a significant enough way to understand, you know, what does it mean to be white. So the older black female hears this and then just walks away. So that was my first one, and I really wanted to be detailed with that because she still is friending this white woman. All right. But she said she blocked all of them, the ones that caused trouble. So I don't think she's out of the trouble yet. And the second report I wanted to make was the same female just got back from her son losing his taste. He couldn't taste anything. So I guess he's starting to get better or whatever. So this white guy, also in the group, right? He only comes over there when she's there. See, because they don't really mess with me. They always go to where she sits. And he says, oh, how's it been going? I haven't seen you in a while. And then she says, hey, you know, calling him buddy and everything. This is what she's saying. No, yeah, I haven't seen you in a while. And he replies back, said, oh yeah, I forgot you have that vid, right? See, so they always like to abbreviate words, cause they think black people make up these, edited terms, COVID. So you have that vid, right? You got that COVID-19, you know, with the kind of country accent. And she's like, oh, so you need to be quiet. I don't have the virus. And then they start talking about, oh man, you know, with this virus, I think many of people that had it don't even realize it. And then he started putting out this slogan, going into slogans, said, I had the vid before it was cool or something like that, before it became COVID. And I just think all of that was just racist linguistics, trying to go into the slang and making edits and modifying words, right? So I started putting all of that in the phone, right? But she was going along with it, right? So he was obviously insulting her. And they didn't seem to have a mask on when they were talking, except for when it got to the end. So that was the second one. My third is my mom had, it really wasn't an incident that was directed at her. It was another black person kept calling white people crackers, right? So, oh, these crackers, they ain't nothing. They think they know everything. So you got two white people that sit at the front counter. They do customer service. So obviously she was going to get pretty much called out on this at some point, you know. So this white person, I'm just calling her white, she was asking to see if my mom would help, I guess, be a witness or something like that for a complaint they wanted to file or whatever. And, you know, we were sitting talking about it, and she said no, because the times that I wanted to address some things, and she would tell her that she doesn't want to get involved. So I'm going to tell you that. That's what approach she went with. So I'm thinking that this black person calling them crackers or whatever, and she says it in front of them, right? So, like, she said to the victim, like, you know they can hear you, right? And she just didn't care. So, you know, cracker, cracker, cracker. So I guess that this person is waiting for the supervisor to come back. But, see, they know that I've been pointing out injustices and racism for years. So I would be interested in knowing how they're going to handle that. Somebody saying some term or whatever. my next one is, there was extreme tackiness going on. I don't know if anybody had something going on about, I think it's Employee Appreciation Day. Because yesterday, the supervisor had balloons and flowers, right, at everyone's desk area. So I wasn't comfortable. She was saying that, well, you know, we're going to have pizza, which would be today, Friday. And I know you like to bring in your own lunch, but you're free to get some if you want. I said, okay, thank you, or whatever. So I took the flowers. I, you know, threw them away. I took the balloon, took it, you know, away from the department. You know, I didn't want to see it. So I was the only one without the balloon and the flowers. So today, I think unjust networking was practiced, because all of the top skilled, refined whites with power and positioning, they did something tacky. Well, first, this white woman went and handed out cards with our names on them. I didn't open the card. I don't know what's in it. And later on, or earlier today, two of the top white people, they come in with this ice cream bell, right? Like, you know, the ice cream truck with the song playing. They had a song playing on, it sounded like on a speaker or something. And somebody had the phone out, the warden, right? And she got this big cheesing smile on her face. And they have this giant cooler with ice cream related products in it. So they go to the black person first, always do that. And they pull out, you know, ice cream or whatever, chocolate, Wilson moment. She get the chocolate. So they say, oh, Blank is on the phone. And I was on the phone. So I thought of something really quick and codified. I had a giant container of water. So they came up to the desk. And I was like, nah, I don't want anything. So I held up the water like, this is what I'm doing. I'm trying to drink this water. So the black person says, oh, nah, he don't eat sweets. I didn't know she was going to say it. She just said it for me. Nah, he don't eat sweets. So they just kept on going. So I'm like, it just made me feel like they were approaching me and the other black person like we were children, even though they went to the other people and said something to them or whatnot. But, you know, it was just very tacky. And I had, if I could just share just one thing. For one, I do think that they are slightly, white people are being themselves, at least the ones that I work with. But I think they're being very refined, especially since I've discovered that the bulk of them have been sharing their true feelings in these little cell phone messages and in these emails. And every time I bring it up, they try to want to hug on black people, want to offer them their jackets and everything like that. Like, they don't want me to see this. So I just continue to make my reports and everything. And we had a black female leave the civil area. It's just been very saddening because her and a black female supervisor has been in conflict, or the supervisor has been mistreating her. But the white females, she don't really seem to treat them that way, which is standard or whatever. So she leaves, and, you know, I congratulate her and I give her, you know, a boost of confidence and everything, because I could tell she was in pain by looking in her eyes. And at the same time she's leaving, a lighter complected female comes in. So I jot that down. It seemed like that's racial to me, you know, racist in a way. But, you know, yeah, those are the things I wanted to share. And there's a lot more going on. And I'm going to continue to examine and observe the white supremacists around me. And that's all I have to share. Thank you for allowing me to speak.
much obliged. Caller in Florida. I see. That's why I say, I mean, I've seen enough white people in the workplace. They didn't seem like they were doing too much faking. Like, maybe they weren't keeping it 100% real, but they were definitely over 90%. Like, it was not a whole lot of, you know, I gotta lie and can't show you my true self. Like, nah, keeping it pretty real. Like, being classified as white does give you a certain amount of power, even in the workplace. Quite a bit of power, especially in the workplace, maybe. I would be about 500 pounds, like all of the snacks and, you know, candy and all the rest of it. It's Employee Appreciation Day, so that's excuse for pizza day and ice cream. Like, no eating in the workplace. And it's the Rona still. Like, why is it pizza day? Like, why is it ice cream day for all of this? We still got the Rona. Like, take it serious. I don't know why that is, you know, cause for us to break out and be back in buffet times. But turn and getting a reputation. I love it. I don't do sweets in the workplace. Thank you kindly. Something does seem kind of, I would totally agree. Something does seem kind of infantile about, I mean, if you're going to, I mean, mm-hmm. even for ice cream, whatever, I wouldn't care if it was granola bars, but I mean, you got to break out the ice cream truck bell and everything. Like, are we supposed to get up and run outside like we're 10? Like, come on, man. In addition to, it's the Rona. Like, come on. Come on. Like, you could put a Baskin Robbins, like, gift card on everybody's desk or in the envelope. Thanks for all you do. Stay safe. No Rona. We'll catch you next year. Whatever it is, you know. It's super easy. You still got your ice cream. Like, come on. And then you're going to come to the black people first? Like, come on. I'm not a child. Oh, it's an ice cream sandwich. Oh, I'm going to, like, come on, come on, come on. No eating in the workplace. Let's see. I know Thomas in New York, we've had other instances of black people using, I don't even what you want to call it, unprofessional language, maybe racial slur. I don't, does cracker count as a racial slur? We've had examples of that happening before. I know Thomas in New York, black self-respect, he addressed it. He went and talked to this person and tried to discourage them from saying this sort of thing. VGQ, I know some victims of racism, hey, they're not my brothers, they're not my sister, I'm not getting involved. Like, I'm not going to talk to them about anything. I'm not going to try to get them to stop doing that. I'd have to ask Thomas in New York if he would do it again. When he went and tried to talk, I believe it was a black female who was saying some unprofessional things and he tried to discourage her from doing this. I would have to ask him if he would do it again, because I think the answer was no, he would not. It can be, you know, a dangerous proposition. I think she stayed in the question lane, his mom, and just going to say, you know, they can hear you. And she didn't care. All right. Cool in the gang. I did my part. Let's move it on. I would not encourage that at all. Like, you would be amazed. Like, yes, they can hear you. The unjust networking, they might go. I mean, it could be anything where white people end up going back and start crying. And, oh, she made, I'm not used to this sort of racial terrorism. And she called me a cracker. And it reminds me of something that happened in first grade. And I mean, be professional in the workplace. I think we even had some folks where it was black people saying nigger, but they were saying it to other black people. I wouldn't recommend that either. Same thing. Like, be professional in the workplace. You could get in trouble with white people for that sort of thing. And I love the not getting involved, too, with his mother as well, where I guess they had a situation before. And the wife said, oh, no. Not trying to pursue justice. Can't help you with that. No way. Beat it. So then it switches around to this. I'm like, hey, do you think you could come and be? Don't want to get involved. Thank you kindly. And keep it moving. Like, love it. Do not have them come and twist your arm, as they say, to come hop in and help them resolve something. Like, nope. Don't know any, especially if it's like a non-white person that you're trying to, you know, do something. Like, nope. Can't help at all. All of the, like, slang incidents, and we've had, like, boatloads of those over the year, where they, because I think he had the one before where the fella, some white guy came in, and it was
oh, yeah, I got the COVID-39 and the COVID-52 and COVID-12 and all of that. And particularly once they get to the bid and the practicing racism, I would not want to be involved with any of it. Why even come to talk to a black person about all of this and wasting it? We're at the courthouse again. We're supposed to be public service, which I would think. Let's make sure we're modeling quality behavior. We've had enough reckless public officials not taking this seriously, modeling poor behavior. Let's at least try to talk about showing your authentic self. Let's try and at least pretend we're going to, nah. Getting my jokes on. Got the vid. Don't you got the vid too? And all the rest. Doesn't get any better than tacky. That's what I mean. Like, now I'm supposed to think, like, is that his inauthentic self? Like, he's faking right now with all this? Like, no. I think that's pretty, that's the ballpark. We're, like I said before, that's at least in the ballpark of what he would be behaving like after 5 o'clock when he's off duty. Let's see.
I agree.
Following logic, man. Just following logic. Let's see. The social media, I mean, can't say it enough times, not being on social media, certainly not being like homies and friends with people you work with like that, even if it was other black people, right? Like, that is dangerous. You have no idea who these folks are friends with. Like, if they see something that you posted on your page and they decide to share it or screenshot it with other people that you're not friends with in the work environment, like, if these are black people, like, you know them. Say, boy, that's your ace boom coon. You went to kindergarten together and all that. You got total trust. Fine. Unless it's something like that, you shouldn't even be like social media friends with non-white people in the workplace. Like, these are not your friends. These are not your homies. Like, social media can cause lots of problems. Let's put it this way. Unless you are super comfortable with everything that you post on social media being available to everyone who works at your job, I would not friend anyone, white or non-white, who you work with. That being said, like, woof, that is super dangerous. Like, you are social media friends with white people and they're like tagging you in posts and things and making racist comments. And then you got to figure this out late and then go block them. Like, oh, and then you don't even block all of the white people. Like, some of them you still think are cool. Like, if you do not understand racism, white supremacy, just as he said, the white people that you think are cool and don't block, they're just going to go back and tell all the white people that you blocked. Like, do you know what that new
thing did? Like,
she blocked all of you.
They all still talk to each other.
How could they not? How could they not? And they do this in all workplaces, incidentally. Just sit around and gossip. They gossip about other white people, too, for sure. But they do spend a lot of time gossiping about other black people. The black people that they like, the black people that they don't like. Niggers is niggers. They spend a lot of time doing this sort of thing. Even back to, I remember that last year with the sundress and, oh, right on, girl, you're rocking it for Juneteenth. And now it does not get any better than tacky. It does not do you any favors to have any friends, if you want to put it in quotes, on your, so where they even have access to your social media platform. You are asking for trouble. And that's so tacky, like, to be calling another white person. Let's say her name was Veronica, just, you know, for what? Oh, shut up, Veronica. What did you call me? Like, what? Using another black employee, that's a racial slur? Like, that's on par with calling you, like, a nigger or whatever? Like, man, what does it mean to be white? Just say that again. Like, come on. Ugh. It does not get any better than tacky at the Florida courthouse. That's repeatedly. I don't even think we've had anybody who's had, like, repeated COVID jokes where they just have people who are coming in regularly and just make their round of jokes about the Rona. And black people, much obliged, caller in Florida. Are there folks we missed, people that we missed totally who had commentary? We nabbed everybody, didn't miss anybody. think I might have missed Bear, your mom. I think I might have missed one person. Sorry, I was late getting to the switchboard. We'll get you first next week. Sorry, Bay Area mom. I think I did miss one person. We will be here tomorrow for a compensatory call in 9 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Pacific. We'll review what happened over the past 7 days or so, conclusion of Black History Month. They were threatening to blow up the U.S. Capitol this week. They haven't even finished the hearings on the Capitol siege, and they have reports they're threatening to blow up the Capitol. White people, I would suspect. They didn't say it was black identity extremists, so I'll suspect the folks plotting are classified as white. But that'll be tomorrow. Did folks we miss, or I assume we didn't miss anybody. Any other folks have commentary they need to get in before we conclude? Everybody satisfied? All right. Assume everybody is grand. We will be here tomorrow, 9 p.m. Eastern, 8 p.m. Central, 6 p.m. Pacific. If you have commentary, we will chat it up tomorrow evening. Much obliged to everyone sharing this evening. Hope it was worthy of your Friday. Man, sobriety would be best. I know it is getting warm. At least it's getting warmer here where you might want to venture out and do things. Great. Stay sober. We will need a high-functioning brain computer to solve our problems. In addition to being sober, if you're going out, be alert to what's happening. I just said they were talking about threats to bomb the Capitol this week in Washington, D.C., amidst all the other mayhem and chaos. I know they're dropping some of the restrictions, social distancing and all that in some states, depending on where you are. So just be very alert. If you go out and it looks like someone is being hostile, loud, take it serious and exit. This is not a time to be engaged in like random verbal confrontations with strangers. You have no idea if this person is armed. In fact, you don't know if this person is armed and with a whole group of folks who are also armed and looking to do harm. If you didn't leave your residence prepared for mortal combat, exit. All of that said, we're sober, buckled. If you're driving, you are not on the cell phone. Just doing the small things that we can to minimize contact with the Mark Furmans of the known universe. If you are driving, as I said, we're trying to minimize contact and we need all of our attention. Make sure we are vigilant about what's happening around us, just trying to stay as safe as we can under very dangerous conditions. All of that said, Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. No name calling, all of that tackiness is a core component of white supremacy, racism. White people train us. They love to see their victims sitting around and calling other black people names. That is not going to help us solve any problems. Cal signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim,
your
brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my condition. Mm-hmm. Even my conditioning has been conditioned.